Let's call a meeting to order of government, or local government.
What do we want to do first?
Okay, I think for first bill is going to be House File 3585, Representative Conan, if you will. Okay, so we don't have to do anything. Yeah. How many people do we need for this? Well, welcome, Representative Conan. We don't quite have a quorum, so if you just want to present the bill, that would be fine.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we'll start with that presentation. House File 3585, what the bill does is allow counties and the Metropolitan Council to own and operate CBED projects, and that's community-based energy development projects. Cities are already allowed in statute to do this, so what it does is give the counties the same authority. Counties and the Metropolitan Council can enter into contracts to purchase or sell electricity, and it also allows for counties or the Metropolitan Council to enter into financing arrangements for energy projects, and this is something that municipalities are already authorized to do also. The utilities and the co-ops, the counties, and especially Southwest Minnesota counties and Hennepin County and the Metropolitan Council have been working on this for several months, and so the bill you see in front of you is a kind of agreement between all of them, and at least at this point there's teeth in the valley on this. I do have an amendment, Mr. Chairman, that I would like to move when we get a quorum, and what the amendment does is will line up this language with the Senate language. I have a testifier here today, Mr. Bob Fox, Renville County Commissioner, and he'll speak to the bill also.
Mr. Fox, you want to identify yourself?
Thank you. Bob Fox, Renville County Commissioner. I also serve as the Vice Chair of the Rural Minnesota Energy Board, which is made up of 18 counties in South Central and Southwest Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. We've been working on this project for a couple of years with the Metropolitan Energy Task Force, which are metropolitan counties of Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, Sherburne, and Washington. We've worked in collaboration with the Department of Commerce, which we've secured a $200,000 grant from the LCCMR to support this project if we can proceed. What this bill does, the bill clarifies that the counties and the Met Councils can collaborate on CBED projects to promote wind energy development. The bill extends to all counties and the Met Council the authority to provide the Winona County generate and aggregate electricity from wind energy conversion systems and to sell that power wholesale. We really are here so we can spur locally owned and generate wind electricity. Small wind energy development and projects may or may not be characterized as seabed, but the projects and seabed share the common goal of spurring this development of locally owned wind electricity. And in closing, I want to give one example. Back 14 or 15 years ago, when the ethanol industry was starting up, there was places where they were just short of money, and the REAs who was going to support that electricity could come in and put that money in and help those things proceed. And I see the counties being able to do the same thing in rural Minnesota, where a project is there, it's community-based, it's locally owned, and we could be there and maybe own that last 5% or 10% and get that project off and running. Thank you.
Representative Coney, any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, we can probably go to questions right now.
Yes.
Do we have a quorum yet?
I don't think we do have a quorum, no quorum. Members, any questions of Representative Coney or the witness? Representative Bitson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Coonan, I have strong objections to a component of this legislation that I want to share with the members of this committee. All right? While counties are comprised of a decision-making body which is elected by the people, I do not understand why we would include the Metropolitan Council in this authority. The Metropolitan Council's area is governed by county boards, And if this language goes into law, the counties that are served by the Metropolitan Council could indeed do this. Right? But with the language that's currently in law, the county itself may object, but the Metropolitan Council could interject its will upon the county. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the elected members of the county could say, this is not something we want to do, because if they could, your language says they could, right? But the Metropolitan Council could say, we're doing it anyway in your county. Right? So I have some strong objections. The Metropolitan Council right now has a defined mission. That mission has crept over the years and has expanded. Right now there is no Metropolitan Council mission along these lines, and so we are again expanding the authority of the Metropolitan Council with little or no accountability except to one person, and that's the governor, who gets to appoint that council. Right now the governor is of my political persuasion. I should be happy. I'm not. Right? Because we have to think long term. Right? We have to think long term, and in thinking long term, I guess I don't understand the addition of the Metropolitan Council. And when we do have a quorum and this amendment is before us, I will offer an oral amendment at that time in which I would move to delete all reference to the Metropolitan Council and keep it a county issue.
Well, Representative Bissons, before you did that, I will call the meeting to order because we do have a quorum now. Representative Cornyn, would you like to respond to Representative Bissons, or is there anyone here from the Metro Council that would like to respond to Representative Bissons or Commissioner Fox? Would you like to?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Fox will.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the first thing I'll start out, and I might also ask for some help from other people, but the MEP Council is a member of the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition, which is the group of all the counties. They're a member of that group, so that's how they got involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I would ask our legal, Chuck, do you have anything?
And Mr. Chairman,
yes.
While he's coming down, I would also like to add that originally when this work began, the idea was to develop wind projects out in southwest Minnesota and to supply a need in the metropolitan area. And I think one of the reasons, and we'll hear more here in a minute, but one of the reasons the Metropolitan Council was included in this is that they're a large user of electricity and would be a customer. And there may be more to this, and we can go to that now.
Representative Cornyn, I think before we hear from the other witness, I will move that House File 3585 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. And you also said you had an amendment. Would you like to do that now?
Yes, let's move the amendment, and then that's what we'll be talking about here anyway. So let's go ahead and move that amendment. It's
you can
the H3585DE1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Cornyn moves his 3585DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, amendments added to the file. Witness, would you like to identify yourself and comment on Representative Biskin's concern about the Met Council's role here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, I am Charles Salter. I'm an Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I also represent the Metropolitan County Energy Coalition. Actually, it's now the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition. There are three parts to this bill. The first part is seabed, and I think the intent of the seabed legislation was to give counties and Met Council power to operate within that area. We are considered counties and regional local governments are considered a qualified owner. The problem with that bill is that neither counties nor Metropolitan Council, which are statutory as opposed to home rule, are given specific authority. And we need that specific authority to actually operate. So even though the intent of the CBIB legislation is to give counties and Met Council that authority, it does not. So one-third of this bill corrects that problem. The other two-thirds involve giving the counties and Met Council specific authority to work outside of CBED to assist other counties in southwestern Minnesota in particular in forming aggregate, assisting aggregate, or individuals, I should say, in the aggregate to work with utilities. We bring Met Council in because they are a member of the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition, and if we are going to participate with the Joint Powers Agreement, since they are a member, we would need the Metropolitan Council included. Otherwise, we, as the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition, could not operate if there's one member of the group who is excluded in this bill. Metropolitan Council is extremely interested. They have the financing, I think, could assist in this bill, along with the other counties, in assisting southwestern Minnesota in developing wind energy. In a nutshell, that's why they were included.
Okay. Representative Biskin raised the issue that the Met Council may be able to approve these projects even in the face of opposition from counties. Is that the way you understand that? Did I correctly phrase that, Representative Biskin?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Is that the case?
They could proceed on their own if counties objected. They're their own political subdivision.
The bill would allow them to do that. Okay, we just want to establish whether or not the bill would allow that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Representative Biskins, you said you had an amendment.
Before I do, I'd just like, Mr. Chair, if I may ask a question of the testifier.
Certainly.
Could you please point out for this committee where in this law does it say that all members of your coalition must be granted this authority or nothing goes forward? I think that was your testimony, that if Metropolitan Council was not granted this authority, and yet we did to all other counties, but because they're part of your coalition, it can't happen.
That's just a law pertaining to joint powers agreement. If we have an entity and there are counties and Met Council, and that entity, the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition, is going to work with southwestern Minnesota with a joint powers agreement. If there's any entity in that agreement that cannot participate, then the entire entity cannot participate.
Then,
Representative Biskin?
Then, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee, all right, a joint powers agreement can always be amended or a new joint powers agreement can be formed. And because we're only talking about seven counties in the metropolitan area, it would be including those seven counties, then the entire group would be back in under a new joint powers agreement, which would be virtually identical to one already out there. Representative Coonan, I don't want to see your bill go through a lot of incredible, what would be a protracted floor debate, etc. I think you're trying to do good things for your area, and I appreciate that, and I wouldn't stand in the way. However, I think the inclusion of the Metropolitan Council and the possibility that the Metropolitan Council, which has been called a political subdivision, I'm not quite sure that fits, a pseudo-agency maybe, its inclusion could trump that of the desires of a county, is going to create more problems than maybe you want at this point. So, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to offer an oral amendment.
You can.
Mr. Chair, on page one, Mr. Chair, basically what I'm going to do is go through the entire bill and strike the words "or the Metropolitan Council." Now I can show exactly where those are. So it's on page one, line 11. Strike "or the Metropolitan Council." Line 13, "or the Metropolitan." Line 14, "council." Line 15, "or the Metropolitan Council." Line 17, "or the Metropolitan." Line 18, Council. Line 22, or the Metropolitan Council. And then, Mr. Chairman, on page, or Madam Chairman now, welcome, on page 3, strike section 4.
Representative Biskins, I just got in the room. Can I ask, you're taking out the Metropolitan Council. Did you give a reason why you'd like to do that, or could I just ask what I missed?
I gave a long diatribe, Madam Chair. I could repeat it.
No,
I
that would be fine it. Not to do that. If you could just give me a short sentence or two so that I can be back on.
Yep, Madam Chair, it's simply because the Metropolitan Council, this is not part of its mission. This is continuing upon the mission creep. As the bill is worded, without the Metropolitan Council, each county within the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Council could still have this authority. So we're not taking away this authority from the people, but we are leaving it to the elected members of the people. As this is read, as this the read-all amendment fits, my county or your county may not want to participate, and the Metropolitan Council could trump them and say, no, we are participating in your county. And that's a concern that I have. And so, I, as I said to Representative Coonan, you know, he's trying to do good things for his area. I appreciate that. He's giving his county the ability to make those decisions. I'd like my county to have the same ability.
All right. Representative Coonan, do you have a response to that?
Madam Chair and Representative Biskin, let me offer this to you. If each of the counties had to give approval to a project that was being brought forward by the Metropolitan Council, would that be, you know, agreeable with you, or do you still want Metropolitan Council out of this?
Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and that's a step in the right direction. However, my broader concern is. On the mission creep of the Metropolitan Council. You know, Representative Coonan, the Metropolitan Council is in charge of systems within the metropolitan area. That includes sewer and water, which isn't doing real good right now, all right? That includes roadways and transit, all right? I think they should focus on a few things and try and get to the point where they do them well, all right, rather than taking on even more at this point.
Representative Coonan.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, we see the Metropolitan Council as a potential very good market for renewable energies, and we don't want to see that go away. And the Metropolitan Council is a large user of electrical power. I mean, you know, this also will give them authority to go into long-term contracts to hedge against higher energy costs in the future. So, I mean, I don't. It could be you're just plain don't. I mean, I'm understanding you don't want it at all, but for some of those reasons, I would sure like to see that stay in. But I'll let my testifiers comment on that too.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Greenville County Commissioner Bob Fox, Madam Chair, Representative. In the seabed language, there is a part in that where if a project was being built in my county, we as a county board have to pass a resolution in support of that. And I was wondering if we could just do something similar to that, that the counties that make up the Met Council, they have to do a support resolution for the Met Council to go forward. I'm really scared if we take the Met Council, this is going to fall apart. And we worked for 2 years, and we've got all the utilities on board, and there's projects out there. And I really, in these projects, I want to be just a helping hand. I mean, I'm not out to start a $500 million project. I want the county to be there, you know, especially in the rural counties, if we can help be the last $2 million. I mean, granted, there'll be some counties that want to go out and do their own big projects. That's fine. But if we had something like that where the counties had one more resolution that they had to get support,
I'm going to encourage members to vote in opposition.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask for a roll call.
That's fine, Representative Biskins. Representative Biskins asked for a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Elstrom?
No.
Sumter?
No.
Silver?
No.
Kelsey?
Aye.
Olson?
Marquardt?
No.
Mancheski? Rainer?
Yes.
Tunin?
No.
House?
Yes.
Holger? Houseman?
No.
Dominguez? Christian?
Yes.
Gears? Members, I'm just going to, given they haven't heard the debate, the total is 7 nays and 4 ayes. The motion does not prevail. Representative Coonan. Representative Galvey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Representative Coonan, I think we all want the same thing here, but in light of what Representative Diskins has offered, we do share, the Metropolitan Council is a taxing authority in the metropolitan area, and they have used the court systems in the past to trump what a city has wanted to do, and they've prevailed. And so there's a little bit of hesitancy on the part of some of us in the metropolitan area to give them even more powers. So I would say that whatever you can do to achieve Representative Diskins' intent here, I think would be helpful as you move through.
Representative Scalzi, I actually have staff looking into an amendment to allow the counties to have the ability to consent. So, further questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, does this need to go anywhere else? This needs to go to taxes, so Representative Coonan, would you be willing to work with me between now and taxes to get some language that would allow the counties to consent?
Yes.
All right.
Go ahead, yeah.
All right. With that, I would move. Who moved it? Did you move it? Representative Stumper would renew his motion that House file as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
All right. Next, Representative Mador. Great. All right, Representative Mador, I would move that House File 3727 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Representative Mador. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Representative Mador, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Rather than going into a summary of the bill, my testifier will just take off from here and give you a... you've moved the bill, yes?
Yes, we have.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's an amendment that's being passed around?
All right. The Chair would move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Mador, go ahead.
Thank you very much again.
Well, you don't have it yet?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'll wait. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And basically what the amendment is, so the committee knows is that it matches up with language that was just presented last night in the Senate, and I'm satisfied with this, so I'm happy to accept it here on my bill. Basically, this is a bill about providing consistency throughout the state for disability parkers, and again, I'll just have my testifier here introduce herself and go ahead and speak to the bill.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
For the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Margot Indick Cross, and I'm an accessibility specialist with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. MUSCOD is statutorily charged with advising and informing state agencies, the governor, the Minnesota legislature, and the public on disability-related issues. Disability parking is critically important to thousands of individuals with disabilities who have difficulty walking or use mobility devices and who need to access their community. Currently, according to federal census data, 20% of the population has a disability as defined by law. 60% of these individuals have some form of mobility impairment. The simple goal of accessible parking is to get people with mobility disabilities to their destination safely. For many individuals with mobility disabilities, the closest, safest place to park is at the parking meter. Disability parking has been in statute since 1953. And up until 2003, the language had always allowed individuals with disabilities to park at meters without paying and without regard to time limits. Many individuals cannot get to the meter, and others don't have the finger strength or dexterity to insert the coins. In regard to time limits, in many instances, individuals with disabilities depend on the extra time because it takes longer to get in and out of the vehicle, longer to get to the destination, and longer to accomplish the task. Existing programs. In 2003, the City of Minneapolis imposed a four-hour maximum limit for people with mobility disabilities on all 1- and 2-hour meters. Disability advocates met for 18 months prior to the restrictions going into effect to negotiate protections for people with who needed accessible parking. In doing so, the city agreed to some allowances so that people with mobility disabilities could still access their communities, didn't lose their jobs, and would be able to afford to park in municipal ramps and lots. The city also provided for special permits to meet the needs of individuals who had specific access issues. The City of St. Paul followed Minneapolis' lead and in 2005 passed the same provisions. Duluth and Rochester have also instituted restricted parking for individuals with disabilities. Unfortunately, in these cities, the time limits are overly restrictive. Duluth has established a 2-hour time limit in certain sections of downtown, and Rochester has restricted disability parking to whatever the time limit is on the meter. In June of 2007, our 21-member governor-appointed statewide council unanimously passed a resolution that supported the creation of uniformity and the establishment of minimum guidelines for municipally initiated long-term disability parking programs. In December of 2007, our council decided to make this issue a legislative priority. The bill before you would establish minimum guidelines that would create uniformity throughout the state when or if a city decided to restrict on-street metered parking. This bill serves to protect the rights and independence of individuals with disabilities who need to rely on-street parking to access their communities. I urge your support of House File 3727. Thank you.
Questions for members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the 50% discount and the rationale for that. I don't understand that.
Representative Medor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Holberg. The issue with that is that for most people with disabilities, in order for them to get to work, they have to own their own vehicle, which means they do not have the option of public transit. So because they have to purchase their own vehicles and drive to work, they don't have the option of carpooling oftentimes. So parking at the ramp is their only option to be able to stay, to get to their job and work at their facility during the day.
Representative Holbert.
Well, and I guess, I mean, I can understand that to a degree, but I'm wondering if by having that in there as a minimum, you are actually going to make it less likely that a city would enact such an ordinance if they don't agree with that position.
Representative Medor.
Madam Chair and Representative Holbert, I don't believe right now that any city has come up to say we're seeing this influx of individuals who have disabilities that need these special permits or have access. Normally right now the requirement for the number of spaces allowable in a parking ramp meets the demand as it exists today. I don't really see that we've had any, there has not been issues from parking companies coming forward saying that, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, Minneapolis and St. Paul willingly agreed to this because in their municipal ramps and lots, they found that their disability parking generally sat empty. And if this got those spots filled, they were more than happy to provide a 50% discount. And if it got folks off the street, they were exceedingly happy to provide a 50% discount. So it's not been an issue up to date. St. Paul and Minneapolis agreed to it willingly, and we're actually very happy to get those spots filled.
I would just follow up and ask the question then, what about Rochester and Duluth? Because that's the reason you stated that you had the bill.
And Madam Chair, Go ahead.
Madam Chair, we proposed these options to both Duluth and Rochester, and they failed to address them. They simply said that they were going to institute the restrictions, and that was the end of our the discussion, basically. And we advised them at that point that if they did proceed with the restrictions to the degree that they were, that we were going to need to get some uniformity throughout the state. We were going to need to address this legislatively, and we were basically told to do what we need to do.
Representative Holberg, I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have another question?
Madam Chair, no, I just think that it might be an impediment to actually their goals, and that some communities aren't going to want to provide that subsidy, if you will, and to have it optional. They might actually get farther than having it mandatory.
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, and this is probably to legal counsel, is this amending a portion of the statute that deals with disabilities?
Madam Chair and Representative Holford, no, this is amending the traffic statute for Chapter 169, and it's a section of law that specifically talks about disability parking coordination.
So,
Representative Holford,
by putting the word disability in line 1.6, Madam Chair, we're not limiting the city to have an ordinance that deals with other long-term parking to just do disability, are we?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, that's right. This is putting in criteria on long-term parking ordinances for disability parking. It's double such to deal with disability parking.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Further questions from members? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along the same line, the heading here says local ordinance long-term parking. It doesn't refer to disability, and it seems to me that with this proposed change in language, we've narrowed this to only deal with disability. Is that not correct?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, no, this is the last subdivision of a section that deals with disability parking. The whole section is on disability parking. And this is just one subdivision at the end of it that talks about local ordinances dealing with long-term parking.
So,
Representative Lanning.
So then there is language in other statutes that gives local units of government the prerogative of establishing long-term parking ordinances.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, yes, for other purposes. This section of law that's being amended deals only with disability parking.
Okay.
Representative Lanning.
Madam Chair, one follow-up question along the lines of what Representative Holberg was asking. It seems to me that being so prescriptive here in terms of what needs to be in that ordinance, that you're actually going to discourage some communities from even enacting an ordinance if they don't like these prescriptions. So I'd have some concern about this having the opposite effect of what you're hoping for.
Further questions from members? All right. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm sorry to come at you with this at the last minute here, but I did just get a telephone call from the City of Rochester who are having their folks review this bill, and they do have some concerns about the requirement that the rate is reduced, and that is a requirement on the city. So I just wanted to get their concerns on the record, and we can continue to talk with the author if necessary.
Questions from members? Okay. Does anyone want to offer an amendment? Representative Holberg.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll just try this, and I don't want to tick people off here, but on line 11 of the delete all, after the word provide, you could insert up to a 50% discount. That would put some discretion in the bill, and I don't know if I don't feel super strongly about this, but I believe this is going to be detrimental to their goal.
Representative Medor.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, at this point, There was great discussion last night in the Senate with regards to this delete all amendment, and the group concurred that this was reasonable. At this point, I don't know if I'd be prepared to accept that because I think I'd like to then work with the metropolitan cities and figure out if that's the final language that we can work with from here. I would hate to have accept something here that the intent at that point might be changed. So I think at this point I'd like to say no, and I'd probably...
If I could advise, I think that it is a serious issue that you're going to have to address before it comes up on the floor. And so I would be fine with you not accepting that amendment at this time, but I think to have a city, no one wants to be against people with disabilities, no one wants to stand in the way, but when a city does finally step forward and say that they have serious concerns, we do not want it to be detrimental to the whole bill.
And Madam Chair, I would agree with you.
Okay, Representative Solberg.
And Madam Chair, just some additional information. I know that in some cities, the parking revenue is the payment of revenue bonds as well. And so I think that just you have to be a little bit concerned about.
All right. Representative Madore, any final closing comments?
No, other than just again, Madam Chair, and the whole idea is here that we're making it easier for people to be able to get to work and have access to parking that meets their needs. And this is a specific group of people with specific group of needs. So,
Representative Holder.
Madam Chair, if you want, I can withdraw the oral amendment. I think they should think this through.
I would concur, Representative Holder. Representative Madore.
And again, the metropolitan cities, they have not come to me with any complaints about this this particular part of this agreement. So I'll have to go back to them and say, and
Madam
Chair,
Representative Fulbert.
You spoke about the Senate work on this bill last night. They're not always right.
Well.
and Representative Madore, I just would comment as well that while the metropolitan cities maybe haven't said anything, the fact that Rochester, having the Mayo Clinic, having lots of people with disability parking permits, are certainly an area that we as a state ought to care about.
Yes.
And so I would look forward to working with you between now and the time you take it up on the general register.
That would be fine, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. All right. Next, Jeremy, Representative Kalin. Okay, members, this bill is technically in finance, but given our short deadline, we were not going to be able to get it, but I thought that it had enough issues that we needed to see it. So it is going to be a brief informational hearing so that if you have issues, you can please bring them up and make certain they get taken care of. Representative Kalin, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, in the interest of being brief, we're done, and thank you for your time. No, just kidding.
Madam Chair, if I might just declare for that your intent to never bring this bill to this committee, is that your intent?
It is my intent that we are not going to bring it here unless there are so many concerns with this committee that we hear them, that we address them, and we believe that we need to kill it this year. All right, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3669 is a bill that... been working very closely with the Department of Commerce on and Energy Savings Advocates. As you know, last year we passed, as part of the Next Generation Energy Act, assertive, aggressive, proactive energy savings goal of 1.5% reduction in electric and natural gas consumption across the state. These are utility-driven programs, but one of the things that we need to do is give more tools to local units of government, to cities, counties, and school districts, this bill does that. The savings goal is exactly that, it's a goal, and I know that this committee is often concerned with unfunded mandates. Actually, what we have here is a funded unmandate. So with me to describe a tiny little bit of the bill, sort of give a quick overview, is Jeremy DeFebre from the Department of Commerce, the State Energy Office, Office of Energy Security.
All right, go ahead. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy DeFebre, the Office of Energy Security at the Department of Commerce. And as Representative Callan said, we've been working with energy advocates and Representative Callan on this bill. It is intended to address what we see as a number of barriers that that state and local government building operators face in addressing energy savings improvements in their buildings. And to do so, it provides a reappropriation of some existing petroleum violation escrow funds that are quasi-federal funds that were awarded to the state actually in 1986 through a settlement between the federal government and Exxon Corporation. Those funds would be used, $1 million of those funds would be used for transfer to the Department of Administration to provide technical services and arrange financing for state building energy improvements. The remainder would be used for a local government program to provide high-quality technical services to determine what the most appropriate and best return on investment improvements could be within various local governments. It would be used to provide a template private financing through lease purchase financing from one or more banks to give essentially uniform, the best uniform rates to all entities that participate in, whether they're Minneapolis or Minnesota, regardless of the size. It would also provide a cash flow guarantee to the participants, and that is that the cost of financing the improvements would not, during the period of financing, exceed the energy savings derived from the improvements. And if that were not the case, we would provide them with a cash flow loan from this fund in order to make sure that the bottom line impact at any time during the finance period was never negative. And that's a significant barrier for cash-strapped entities to go into an energy saving improvement that is not their area of expertise, relying on states that it is actually not going to have a negative bottom line impact for them. So we structure a guarantee that ultimately keeps them revenue positive, however allows us to recapture whatever we might have to provide within that guarantee.
All right, questions from members. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I was reading it. And the source of funds for this are what?
Representative Callan.
I'll defer to Mr. DeCibre to note the funding a little bit better.
It's petroleum violation escrow funds. They were part of a settlement for pricing violations in the 1970s. The settlement was a court case that concluded in 1986, and $36.5 million came to Minnesota at that time. These are about the only funds that remain. They've been in a revolving loan program since then.
All right, questions from members. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, two questions. As I understand it, you would give a more than just technical support. You're giving the ability for a city to spend some money, and then hopefully they will save resources, save money, and pay back their expenditures through the savings. And if they don't, then you would, that doesn't work out, then you would give the city a loan, or the entity a loan from that fund, is that correct?
Mr. DeFree.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Close enough, right? Yes, from this fund we would provide essentially a loan to allow them to have at worst a net neutral cash flow during their what is the finance period that's been arranged with a private financing entity. They would then, after that finance period, have to pay us back as long as that does not put them in a negative cash flow at that point. We do not want to refinance the financing itself, because that ultimately, if we were in that, that would affect the pricing of those lease finances that we would get bids on.
Representative Solberg.
Well, I'm a little concerned about the techniques on this. I mean, you're almost going down the road, as I look at it, as a moral obligation for the state. I recall the St. Cloud bonds for conversion, and they were from natural gas or oil into biomass at the time, wood chips, and they were sold revenue bonds, and the bonds are supposed to be paid off by the savings, and the savings didn't occur because the natural gas price went down, and bondholders were left holding the bag. And even though it was a revenue bond, it became almost, we ended up bailing out the bondholders in the state because it was determined it was a moral obligation bond. But I'm a little concerned about your mechanism here of what kind of moral obligation you may put your fund in, because I understand you want it as a revolving fund, and if you have losses in that revolving fund, you don't have any revolving of the fund.
Mr. DeFebri? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Solberg. I think the question goes to... our hope is to recapitalize that fund, not quite truly make it a revolving loan fund because of its nature of backing these lease purchase agreements. But I think that the issue of the savings, the department has worked with a very fine pencil to work things out with Wells Fargo, with the school districts, with the with department administration and others to make sure that the savings that are being promised are being delivered, and I believe that sort of goes to the very question there. Because the utilities are also partners in the Conservation Improvement Program, and we've put very rigorous measurement and verification requirements on the Conservation Improvement Program that have had a proven track record of delivering savings, that that we should be in. I'm quite confident that we'll be actually delivering that savings both on energy and on cost, and I think that we'll be recapitalizing the fund very nicely out of the fund. If we end up having to take some losses, they'll be very, very minimal, and be able to continue recapitalizing and doing the work that we want to do. No, Mr. DeFebri.
Mr. DeFebri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the things we intend to do is, much like in lenders having debt service coverage, we intend to look at having a margin of error of, if we anticipate that there is going to be $20,000 in annual savings from a package of measures, we might structure the financing and cash flow such that we would, in order to make the guarantee, we might only need 80% of that in order. So we do want to act both conservatively in looking at the types of assessments that we do on the potential return on the investment, but also then give ourselves a bit of coverage so that there is a bit of room margin.
Representative Solberg, actually, this bill is in finance, and these are the issues within the purview, really, of the Finance Committee. And so I would encourage the two of you to get together and work this issue out before finance.
Madam Chair, I have one other question. That's on page 4, subdivision 3. It's a little bit unusual to see that you are, in effect, specifying a Minnesota not-for-profit organization to deliver that. Can you tell me why subdivision page 4, line 4.4 in the bill?
Mr. DeFebri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I believe in the delete all amendment that was passed out of energy finance and policy that language was stricken, and it merely says that we can contract for those services without designating any type of entity.
So we don't have the right, Madam Chair, the right version in front of us?
Representative Solberg, we were told by House Supply that this is the most recent version, but apparently it is not the most recent version.
Well, I think we need to have a clarification on that. That is the purview of the committee.
Absolutely. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll actually read that from the DD amendment, which was very minor in substance, I believe, that there was very small changes made, and I'll just read that new subdivision. The title, I believe, oh, sorry, it's not. The title does change. Subdivision 3, primary contractor for technical, financial, and program management services. The commissioner may enter into a contract for the delivery of technical services, financial management, marketing, and administrative services necessary for implementation of the program. I hope that's broad enough, Representative.
Representative Kalin, is there anything else in that DE amendment that would be within the purview of this local government committee? Because otherwise I'm going to table this and wait till we get a copy of it. So,
Mr. DeCibre,
go ahead.
We'll be able to address it.
Mr. DeCibre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other change is, I believe in the version you have, it has a single program addressing state and local government buildings within 216C. The language related to state buildings was removed from that and put into 16B, Department of Administration statute. It seemed to be more appropriate there.
All right. Questions, Representative Biskin?
Madam Chair, I think you're wise and your counsel to lay this bill over until we do get the proper bill, because based on what your staff has been told, you know, has this even moved to this committee officially? Is it even legally within our purview?
This is within the, we are having an informational hearing on this bill, and I announced that. I'm sorry you had stepped out of the room. And so, excuse me, I made it clear to members that we're not going to be able to get it in time to meet deadlines. So if this committee wants to kill this bill, I will request this bill to come here from the floor. But if it is the intent, I thought we would give it the opportunity to hash out the issues that have to deal with local government here. And if the committee so chooses, I will make the motion myself on the floor. Representative Solberg.
Well, Madam Chair, I think if we can count on the witness to identify those particular changes, the one I identified is mine has been satisfied with that, and the other one seems to be a technical change that, so I'm comfortable with it if that's the changes that were made and are not reflected in this bill. As I glanced over the bill, my concerns would have been addressed.
Madam Chair, if I might offer, given the informational status and the formal status of the bill, I will personally make sure that every member of this committee has a photo, has a copy of the engrossment out of energy, distribute around to make sure that every member has a chance to review and offer to answer any questions as well as yours. And if we do need to formally, if you wish to formally bring it to this committee, I wouldn't say happy to do so, but willing to do so. But I believe that we really are providing a tool. I think Representative Solberg's financial questions, we need to make sure our answer thoroughly, but I believe we are providing a tool to local government. The bill is supported by the School Boards Association, and I believe Craig Johnson here from LMC to testify in support of the bill as well, if you care to.
I do believe that we have two people that would like to testify against the bill. So if you could send your copy with a page to copy that delete amendment, we will have the people that are opposed come to the table. We can ask questions, and we're going to keep moving along. Otherwise, we're going to be here all night. So those who want to test, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question of the Department of Commerce, if I may, please.
Oh, certainly. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, yeah, there is on Subdivision 7 of page 4, the positive budget impact guarantee. And if a local unit of government enters into this contract with the expectation of a guarantee and the positive budget impact isn't met, who's liable for that guarantee? Is that not then the state of Minnesota?
Mr. DeCibre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, although I believe the way we would, and this gets to the question about moral obligation, perhaps it would be appropriate to clarify that it is not a moral obligation to stay within the statute. However, the fund that it would be dedicated to this would be the only source for that guarantee. So we do need one of the requirements in reviewing a potential contract is to say, do we have adequate funds in order to fulfill the guarantee?
Representative Biskin.
So, Madam Chair, and to the witness, has that potentiality been factored into any fiscal note that has been developed for this bill so that, I just don't want school districts and local schools of government going into a situation where it says there's a guarantee and then the state of Minnesota liable for that guarantee and then the Department of Commerce saying, well, there's no money for it. Right? Because they went in good faith, it will come back to us then as legislators to find the money somewhere, and we, not a lot of free money laying around, so that probably means cut somewhere else.
Mr. DeFebri, did you follow the question?
I believe I did, yes. Thank you. I believe our approach would be to, and this is based on the necessity of limited funds, is that the approach to the guarantee would be a limited guarantee, that it would have to be expressed that that is the only recourse.
Alright, further questions? Alright, seeing none, anyone who wishes to testify for or against this bill, please come to the table, state your name for the record, come to the table. State your name for the record, and while you're getting ready to do that, actually, I want to let the members know that the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School are here. They are participating in the Minnesota Historical Society's Capital Historic Site Voice of the People, Your Role in Government Tour and Educational Program. So please welcome them. All right, state your name for the record.
Oh, it should follow something like that. Madam Chair, my name is John Carter. I'm with Honeywell. First of all, we are all about energy savings and energy efficiency. We have been doing projects like these for over 20 years, both in the state of Minnesota and across the country. So I think we want to start with that we are in favor of anything that promotes energy efficiency and helps us to achieve better control of greenhouse gas emissions and so on. However, we do want to make it clear that we have some concerns about this bill, and one of them is frankly exactly what was being discussed previously. The effect of this bill is to disconnect the incentives for the contractor to make sure that the savings happen and really transfers that risk, we believe, to the state. So that it's not in the best interest of the contractor, or the state, I'm sorry, to do something like this, because in the present situation, the contractor is responsible for those savings. And if the savings don't occur, the contractor must pay to the school district or the city or whomever the difference between what was guaranteed to be saved and what was actually saved. That's the way it works right now. So that's a very big concern of ours, that it opens up the state to essentially an uncapped liability in that way. The second thing that we are concerned about, frankly, is expertise. Again, over the last 20 years, energy service companies like Honeywell and others have developed a lot of expertise in how to work programs like this. We know how to identify what savings are available. We know how to measure and verify that those savings will happen. And frankly, we have really worked very hard to make certain that these programs actually deliver what they say they're going to deliver. The other two issues really come down to accountability. Under this proposed legislation, we're concerned that the single source accountability presently placed on the ESCO to make sure that the program works as it's supposed to gets kind of derailed. And it's not just about savings. When these projects go in, they also have to make sure they heat and cool and light the buildings properly for the long term. Many of these projects are 10, 15 years in length. So we want to make certain that there's, we call it a single nose to push if something doesn't go wrong. When you start divvying out the responsibility for projects of this sort, that single source accountability goes away. Our final concern, frankly, is just that we deal with energy performance contracting really across the country, and this is not what most states and, in fact, the federal government and other entities are doing. And I'll cite just very quickly the example of the Clinton Climate Initiative, which is a very active group attempting to, again, reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. And they explicitly adopted the performance contracting procedure where the ESCO is, in fact, responsible for the savings and guarantees them over the long term. So in summary, we're concerned. We definitely want to, again, promote energy efficiency. We believe this bill has some concerns in terms of allocation of risk in terms of potential costs to the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, to the testifier, if I may.
You may.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We try to keep some of the local within the local government jurisdiction and not within the Finance Committee, please.
Well, and again, I try to see things from a local government. My last line of questioning, of course, was local governments and a guarantee. And so I will use my cerebral gymnastics to try and make sure I stay within those boundaries. To the testifier from Honeywell, you know, what Representative Kalin is trying to do is very laudable, all right? As a chartered school director of finance right now down at the Landmark Center being a very old building, energy is a big concern for us, and it's a big cost driver. So we're looking at ways to find energy savings. And I think what Representative Kalin is doing is he's saying we're not going to sit on our hands and let this go. All right. And it sounds like we're all in agreement. This is something we should move forward with. Now, you mentioned very quickly in your testimony this isn't what other states are doing, but you didn't tell us what other states are doing. Could you elaborate and tell us what some other states are doing?
Sure. Very briefly. In most other states, for public entities, schools, counties, municipals, etc., almost all of those require a written guarantee from the energy services company to proceed with a performance contracting of this kind. Without that, they do not have the exemption to enter into these kind of contracts. Okay.
Representative.
And Madam Chair, then, to the testifier, would that be something that is acceptable to the contractors who are working here in Minnesota? I mean, or if Representative Kalin were to come up with a piece of legislation which would require that guarantee of the contractors, or there is nothing, all right, would they be here screaming and hollering, saying, don't do that to us, don't do that to us?
Mr. Carton.
No, in fact, I believe that is approximately the legislation as it exists now here in Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? All right. I believe there was a Jim Garrard as well. Please come forward, state your name for the record. Try to keep your comments within the jurisdiction of the local government committee and not within finance. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Garrard. I'm with Cook Hill Garrard Associates, and I'm representing Johnson Controls today. And about all I'm going to say is that I think the Honeywell person summed up our position very well. I would point out that there is already over $150 million in these kinds of energy savings contracts in the state of Minnesota that are currently in place under the existing law. I think with that I'll just say that we agree with the testimony from Honeywell.
All right. Further questions from members? All right. Seeing none, is there anyone else? State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. I will be very brief. The League of Minnesota Cities strongly supports this legislation. This is a voluntary program cities can choose to enter into, along with any other local unit of government, make energy efficiency improvements to a structure that they own and operate and feel that they need to improve. We have many cities right now that are using vendors like the ones you've just heard testimony from. This does not prevent them from continuing that relationship. They can do that if they choose. Those vendors can also choose to qualify for this program, bring their own plans for improving a building in, and have the same sort of support, both technically and financially, for funding the projects that are available through this program. So because of the new language, it does not limit it to a single nonprofit group qualifying to work underneath this program. We think it's an excellent new tool for cities. We have cities feeling a very both because of changes in statute in recent years and ones that we know are coming soon, and because of this public desire, a real need to take on a leadership role in demonstrating that we're concerned about energy impact and energy efficiency. This program would help us achieve those goals.
All right. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, there are projects like this existing right now coming through the private sector. What is so magical about this presentation, this bill, and what does it add that it's compelling enough that we need to add another layer of state government for our local governments to work through.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I think this has several useful things for cities. One is not everyone has a contract with a large environmental control specialist company for their community. They may not even have enough infrastructure to be a real attractive client for those companies, especially for rural communities or ones that maybe currently work through a different vendor to supply their environmental controls for their buildings. So I think that's one area that's missed. We have thousands of smaller old buildings that are not necessarily good customers for a major type of retrofit like that, but could be low-hanging fruit that if they got the right advice, the right technical information on are windows really going to do it, or should we do something else that would be a better energy saving for this building, that would help them decide what they should be doing more accurately and would help them do the fiscal analysis to make sure it's actually going to pay off. These programs, the criteria are designed to make it so, for instance, if the energy payoff for the improvement is going to be 6 years, the financing will get laid out over a longer period than that to make sure there's the cushion there to get this program to pay itself off. That's a very good thing for small communities that aren't used to dealing with these kinds of capital improvements.
Representative Beard.
But, Madam Chair, and sir, if I was a small contractor, I think I would specialize in that kind of stuff, running around there, just as a private business in Worthington or Windham or wherever, trying to find that kind of project. Because I know Wells Fargo is pretty active in this area, too, and I think they got a branch bank in almost every small town in this state. Again, are we duplicating a service that the private private sector has or should? By our presence, are we going to be stomping on little guys who are trying to get started? That's my question.
Whichever one wants it, take it.
Madam Chair, I'll answer briefly, and I think the author has a response, too.
Of course.
My very short response is the first I heard of this program was from a representative of Wells Fargo who came to the League and suggested we look at supporting this program as a way for them to help get this service out to a broader scope of communities.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Beard, you're actually articulating exactly the shortage that's happening right now. Is we don't have enough energy engineers, we don't have enough capacity. Honeywell and I have talked actually about getting more, filling that capacity through the MINSCU and the university system, that the private sector to reach this aggressive savings goal that we adopted last year will result in thousands and thousands and thousands of new jobs. Johnson Controls themselves, that Mr. Gerard represents, is adding 25,000 jobs in the near future in the United States because of the energy savings activities. There's just not enough, there aren't enough players in the market yet, and as you'll read through the bill, you'll see the technical services most likely will be from the smaller players that aren't part of the energy service company.
Madam Chair, I think I heard you mention earlier that if we need to bring this bill back, any one of us can just ask you to do so, and you'll bring it back from the floor?
My comment was, in the event we want to kill this bill as a committee, I will be making the motion on the floor to bring this bill into this committee, but it will be killing the bill for the year. So if there are issues that need to be worked on, we can work with the author between now and where he is in finance.
Madam Chair, I think there are some issues, and I'm sorry I had a previous conflict, which, oh, by the way, included a gentleman who's just transitioning careers into this very field because of the demand that's been created by our mandate. He's going into environmental engineering specifically to help these things happen with a private company in the Twin Cities that's really ramping up for it. So I do have some concerns about where the bill's going. I know my name is on. It was on the original bill. It will be coming off in today's motions and resolutions because I've got some grave concerns about several things that have transpired since I signed on to it. So can we talk about that?
I'm happy to chat with you. Again, we're trying to limit this discussion in this committee to the local government issue. But I'm happy
this
to chat.
This is all about you. Local government in my estimation, Madam Chair.
All right.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. So with that, Representative Kalin, I'm going to end this informational hearing. And we will be chatting after this hearing. And with that, actually, former representative and current state auditor Rebecca Otto is in the room, and I have her bill, and I'm going to do that bill for secret access. Her bill work. So with that, I'm going to sit in this chair and continue to chair the meeting and present the bill from here. I will move that House File 3522 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a technical bill, very basic. It's a common sense change that I hope you will support today. Counties, Minnesota counties are required to report to the Office of State Auditor summary budget information annually. And when I got into this office, I found a few things that need changing. This bill is going to change the date by which counties must annually provide their summary budget data. In statute before it was December, right now it's December 31st. What we want to move it to is January 31st. And reason being is that they can't physically get their summary budget data together for us by the current statute deadline. And so it's just a change to match practice. I don't like having things in statute that can't be followed because then sometimes you set up a precedent of, well, we don't have to follow that rule, so should we follow this rule? So I just want to get it into what's actually happening out there.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 3522 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Kalin, you can come back and present your next bill if you're shorter. Where are you? He left the room. All right, so I guess he's not next. Representative Loeffler, are you in the room? You're next. Representative Loeffler, I will move that House File 3692 be recommended pass and be placed on the general register. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Diane Loeffler, honored to represent a community that borders the Mississippi River in Minneapolis. And with me is Council Member Diane Hochstead from Minneapolis and Park Commissioner Scott Vreeland from the Minneapolis Park Board, who are only available to answer questions because I know you have a very full agenda.
Great.
And I do have an amendment.
I was just going to ask, is Amendment 1313 yours?
Yes, it is.
Okay, yes. I would move the Amendment 1313 to get the bill in the order the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the amendment, while it is a delete, everything just clarifies some of the language, and it originally was drafted to have an initial board and then a permanent board, and we thought we didn't need the two steps, so it's just combining it into one. And for over a year, all the parties who are interested in the Minneapolis Riverfront and revitalizing it, the environmental interests, the cultural and heritage interests, developers from the private sector, the city, the park board, and our arts community have been meeting together. In fact, this is the notebook of all of our meetings. That have been looking at what other communities have done in terms of doing coordinated, environmentally and responsible and thoughtful redevelopment, and have, after looking at those models, recommended that we do what many communities have done, which is establish a new nonprofit corporation to bring everybody around the table to work together, and so that there's sort of one spot where people can go to get information about what the plans are. They know, there's someone who knows what the Mississippi Watershed concerns are, what the park board plans are, what the city plans are, and that we can work together in a coordinated fashion to implement the plans that everyone around the table has agreed to. And it basically outlines the board of the corporation, the responsibilities. It's able to do fundraising as nonprofit organizations and others who are less comfortable giving to government directly. It can provide communication structure, but what it will not do is replace the existing, you know, governmental authority to the partners around the table. It will instead facilitate the work so that we can actually do things in a coordinated way and have sort of a one-stop shop for people to approach us as we work to implement our revitalization plan. With that, I would be glad to answer questions.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this is for Ms. Dyson. Can you give us a little background on 317A corporations? Other examples that it says here that they're going to be able to acquire and dispose of real estate. I'm assuming that relates to some kind of debt.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Holbrook,
Chapter 317
is the statute governing small corporations. And Madam Chair, then if I might for the testifier, then do you see this group having the ability to assess fees, or how are they, other than the donations, how are they going to be funded?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, it's expected, this is not expected to be a group that acquires data, and that's not one of their authorized authorities, but it is expected to be a group that would be able to, through funding of its nonprofit partners or donations. We've already had, for example, one donation of private land from a private landowner, and think that's kind of more the model that is envisioned. It's a model that's been used successfully, we're told, by the St. Paul Riverfront Redevelopment effort. Sometimes that's an advantage to someone who might be interested in that type of an approach.
And
Representative Holbert,
Madam Chair, if I might then, so you are not going to be seeking authority to levy or collect tax dollars or what money? Are you going to get money from the city?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, right. The authority to all public authority still resides within the Minneapolis City Council and the Minneapolis Park Board and their authorizing statutes.
And if I might, Madam Chair, is this group, will this group be subject to the open meeting laws?
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, I would assume so, even though only a small portion of its membership on the board is public officials. That would be the intent, and I'm not sure about nonprofit law, if that applies to nonprofit boards. Perhaps Council can answer that.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg. There's a longer answer to that, but it sums up with, I think it might be unclear, so that if you want this board to be subject to open meeting law, it's probably specified back in 99 to 2001, there was an interim task force on corporate decrees by political subdivisions, and this law is giving them authority to establish that. The way the statute is drafted, it's a little unclear about corporate decrees after 1999, but all of the ones that were grandfathered in, it's stated that they are subject to open meeting law, data practices, others, and they cannot opt out of it. But it's not clear that all of that language in 465.719 applies to corporate decrees after that. So my recommendation is, if you want laws like that to be applied without question, then I think it needs to be specified.
Madam Chair, I don't want to take any more committee time, but I do think, given the amount of public entities that are involved with this, it would be important that they be subject to the open meeting law and those standards, and maybe before this gets to the floor, there can be a little amendment to say that.
All right. Further questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, all those in, I would renew my motion that House File 3692 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Representative Hornstein, you're going to do one bill, and then we're going to let Representative Hilke go. So, Representative Hornstein.
Good afternoon.
Is it House File 3323 that you want to take first?
Correct.
That's correct. Okay, I would move that House File 3323 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. House File 3323 builds on legislation that was passed in 2006 to permit the City of Minneapolis to impose a park dedication fee on new housing units. The law limited park dedication fees to new residential housing units only and required both the City of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Park Board to adopt an ordinance to implement the law. Other cities across the state already have similar authorization to use park dedication fees to help pay for new parks and park amenities, and so this simply enabling language for the City of Minneapolis. So, following the legislation, last year, the Minneapolis Park Board adopted an ordinance to implement the law. After the Park Board adopted the ordinance, the City Council considered the matter and requested that the Park Board seek legislation to allow the park dedication fee to be imposed on new commercial and industrial development or redevelop in the city, and I emphasize new development. Both the Park Board and City Council support the addition of this commercial and industrial property provision. And again, we're simply following precedent. Other cities apply the park dedication fees to both housing and commercial and industrial properties. The general state law allows cities to impose the fee on both types of properties. The bill still leaves it up to the city and the park board to decide the level of the fee. And we believe the fee must be reasonable and proportionate, and it must directly benefit the property. So I do have Park Commissioner Tom Nordyke here, if there's any questions of him. And I really appreciate the committee hearing the bill.
All right, questions from members. Representative Holberg.
Madam Speaker, Representative Hornstein, what's going to come here in 2010 that you're going to attach and add on to this?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, at this time, we have no additional park dedication fees planned. This is coming at the request of the city, and I'm not aware of any additional plans for the year 2010.
And
Representative Holberg.
Madam Speaker, and this will be my last question, does the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board have taxing authority now?
Representative Hornstein.
In addition to these fees, of
yes,
course.
But I will have Commissioner Nordyke specifically inform you of those.
The tax authority of the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board is governed by the Board of Estimate and Taxation, which has the mayor, president, and city of Minneapolis is governed by that as well. So
and
while we have that authority, we cannot exercise it without that.
And if I might, so just for clarification purposes, you are imposing property tax on commercial property in the city of Minneapolis for park purposes at this time?
First on residential property taxes, yes.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, further questions from members? All right, seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 3323 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All
members,
right,
I'll be back.
Representative Tilsey, you were next. I would move that House File 3662 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Hilsey, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do need to make a couple of amendments to the bill. I think the committee has one that actually itself needs to be amended. With your indulgence, I will explain the bill briefly. This bill arises, it came to the attention of Senator Laurie and myself because of a recent occurrence in Pike County in which one of the commissioners resigned his office with a considerable part of the term remaining in order to take a different position with the county. And there wasn't any clear process for making his replacement. The county board did make an appointment to fill the term, and that was consistent with state law. But what we realized at the time is that there is no provision in state law to actually have hearings to allow for any public input in the process. And what this bill is intended to do is address that. We have, since in conversations with the League of Minnesota Cities in particular, realized that the way the city situation is addressed in the bill is not really workable in its present form. Senator Laurie is working with the league to find language that would be workable, but it does not exist in the bill in its current form, and so the amendment that was drafted by the league proposed to delete Section 4, but there are actually problems in Section 3 as well, and Madam Chair, what if you would be so kind as to make the motion, I would wish to delete both Section 3 and Section 4 from the bill.
So moved. Any questions from members on the deletion of those two sections? Representative Holberg first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hilty, the reason you're deleting Section 3, is it because the cities oppose it, or is it because there's something structurally wrong with the language in it?
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, my understanding is in there is a representative from the league that could explain that probably better than I, but I believe that the situation is that it just needs to be, that there are structural changes that need to be made that I did not feel comfortable with trying to make on the fly. So I thought that it would be preferable to take this up in conference with the Senate version and make sure that it got...
Representative Holberg.
Okay. And Madam Chair and Representative Hilty, and if the problems are then some type of structural problem, then are they replicated in Section 1, Subdivision 4? Because it looks like the language is exactly the same, just relating to counties on page 1.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I believe that the reason that there's a problem with the city thing is that the whole structure of city government does not comparable to counties, and I don't believe that the counties actually have any problem with the language addressing the county equation.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Representative Silpe, and I did have as long as you're deleting Section 3 and working on that, I did have a comment from a constituent regarding the mayor being able to make the appointment, because it would maybe be only four people there, and say a mayor and a council member are in agreement, so it's a tie vote. Is that what you're going to be doing with the structural changes?
Representative Hilke.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I have had communication about that also, and that's certainly one of the issues that needs to be addressed.
And Craig Johnson is here if we'd like him to come to the table, and he can talk about the issue. But I also have a question from Representative Olson. So, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilke, half my question is gone because Section 4 is gone, but in Section 2 on line 2.5, the public notice language there, given in the same manner as for a special meeting, can you tell us why you chose public notice instead of published notice? Published notice would require to go to the newspaper for all the citizens of the jurisdiction to hear their legally established newspaper. The public notice is just simply putting it on the principal bulletin board on the door of its usual meeting room. Could you explain why you chose that language?
Representative Hilke.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, perhaps council could shed some light on that. I'm not aware that public notice is that narrowly defined. It would not necessarily be my intention.
All right, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilty, for your reference, published notice is a specific provision in statute of 645.11, and the provision I believe you've referred to, if counsel would correct me if I'm wrong, is in Chapter 13D.04, I think, Subdivision 2, because your language here specifies, refers to special meeting. Public notice given in the same manner as for a special meeting. That is subdivision 2 under 13D.04. And it lays out how it's done, and there's quite a difference in the notice, and I'd much feel much better about your bill if we had published notice there.
Ms. Bateson?
I guess I'd want to look at it more.
All right.
Well, Representative Holt is referring to the open meeting law notice requirements for special meetings, and I don't know if there's some other statute for county special meeting notices, but I'd have to look at it.
Okay. All right. Mr. Johnson, if you'd like to answer the question up earlier.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson, again, with the League of Minnesota Cities. specifically to the structural question asked earlier by Representative Holberg. The subdivision or Section 3 of the bill is related to a structural problem. Cities have a different election requirement than counties in that there are certain times we are prohibited from having special elections. And this doesn't take into account that that might occur during one of those prohibited times. So we need to work out a different solution there for Section 3.
All right. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this bill as drafted, and I appreciate Representative Hilty removing Section 3 and 4, but is it intended to apply both to statutory as well as home rule cities?
Mr. Representative Hilty, do you want to answer
Madam
that question?
Chair, Representative Lanning, well, at this point it's not intended to apply to cities at all.
So I...
Representative Lanning.
Representative Hilty, I thank you for taking these sections up. My question was, the way it was originally drafted, would it apply to both statutory as well as home rule? And if it does apply to home rule, I see serious problems with making these changes.
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I believe, and you could verify this with the council, but I don't believe it does refer to home rule cities.
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, under Chapter 412, that applies only to statutory cities unless the home rule charter city wants to use authority granted in that law, and their charter doesn't
prohibit
it, but it does not automatically apply to
homeless services.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hilty.
If I could beg your indulgence, there are a couple of clarifying amendments that need to be made to Section 2.
Okay. Will those be verbal amendments?
Madam Chair, on line 2.6, I would strike receives and insert invite.
Okay.
In line 2.9, delete make a reasonable effort to consult with and insert notify. And on line 2.12, delete consulted and insert notified.
Questions from members? Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilty, I just need clarification on subdivision 4 on page 1.
Let's take care of the amendment that
we're
going
first. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Concerns from members? All right, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilty. I'm concerned with where you've changed it to 1 year remains. I have a question to ask you, and if you can answer it, then maybe I'm okay. What if, because the reason I put this in, was it last year or the year before? I can't remember when I put it in, but we had an instance where a county commissioner died in Las Vegas. On the final day of filing or the day after filing, we had to have a special election. We had to advertise in the local newspaper before his body was buried because it took a couple days to get the body from Las Vegas to Minnesota, to Walker, Minnesota, and it hurt the family tremendously that we had to advertise in the paper to have a special election. Now, have we changed anything, or is there anything different? Can we have a vacancy in a county commissioner's seat until that November? Because that obviously would be less than a year, and have a regular election at that time, or how would we work that out?
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Representative Howes. As you see on line 18, it's really just changing from the 2 year requirement to a 1 year requirement. it doesn't really change the requirement for a special election. It only changes the parameters.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, I'm going to vote for it today, but can I work with you a little bit? The only thing I'm thinking that 15 months might work better, but I'm not positive it will. And I'd like to talk to the Secretary of State's office to find out why 1 year was the magic number.
All right. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if I'm asking the right question, but I wonder if this has any impact on cities that their terms, they have their elections on odd-numbered years. So does this, in section number one, because it says you can only, if you have less than 1 year remaining, let's say it's 2008 and your term is up in 2009, and it's after the general election in 2008, and a person has less than 1 year, and they pass away, and now it says they're not filled until the next county general election, when actually their term ends in 2009. Well, and I suppose the city election, though, would just supersede. I just need clarification on that. I suppose the city election would supersede that, but here it does say it has to be at the county general election and not either at the next city election or the county.
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, perhaps you were not in the room at the time, but we did delete sections 3 and 4, so the bill as it stands currently does not apply to cities at all.
Oh, that. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's what section 3 and 4 does. It removed the cities. Okay. Never mind. Then we're okay.
All right. Our Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, it's a good bill. I'm going to support it.
All right. Further questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up on my concern about public notice and curious if counsel confirmed my points.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, you're correct about what public notice means. What I don't know is if public notice has any other definition or scope or what custom that counties follow. It's a very common precedent or usage in the section that requires public notice and hearing. So I guess I would want to know if the counties have any further information. I don't have information on whether or not there's a definition of public notice. And you referred to just posting it on the bulletin board. That's what townships do, and that's part of how township government works. But I don't know if at the county level it has some other definition. Just scanning through some county statutes right now, I'm not finding anything. But you are correct. Public notice is very specific meaning for publication in a qualified newspaper.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Hilty,
if I may, Representative Olson, the whole intent of this bill, of course, is to make these proceedings more public, and so there's certainly no intent in the bill to cause them to be less public than they could be, and I'm certainly willing to work with you and to pursue this question if your suggestion needs to be implemented. I'm happy to do that.
Madam Chair, that is thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, Representative Hilty. I'll show you my documents following the meeting, and we can discuss it. I appreciate your accommodation.
All right. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Terry Moses, Roseville, Minnesota.
Sorry?
Terry Moses, Roseville, Minnesota.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm here to speak in favor of this bill and to make two additional requests. Number one, that you delete the sentence in line 2.16, which reads, in the case of a tie vote in the council, the mayor shall make the appointment. This is unnecessary. The counties don't have that provision. The mayor and council in 99% of cities in Minnesota are supposed to be equal, have equal standing. So therefore, giving this kind of extraordinary power to the mayor is undemocratic. It is very unrepresentative since it allows the mayor to pick someone that the other council members have not even had a chance to consider. They can pick a name out of the air. If there's a simple tie vote.
Okay, I just wanted to make it clear that that section has been deleted from the bill, so it's not in there anymore. So the part that you want to change has already been changed.
That sentence?
Yep, that whole section has been taken out of the bill.
So will this bill affect municipalities at all?
The bill does not affect municipalities at this point at all.
Madam Chair.
Representative Fiskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but to the witness, just a clarification. All right? Those words are already in law.
Yes, okay.
Representative Hilty is not inserting those words into law. Right? So those are, the mayor can do that in law. Representative Hilty is bringing in a different issue, so he's not touching that issue at all. That'd be a new bill for somebody else.
I understand, but this sort of goes hand in hand with it, and we wanted that deleted.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Further questions for members? Apparently, we moved the First Amendment, but we didn't vote on it. So the A1 amendment that was amended to include deleting Section 3 and 4, we did not vote on. So all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Anyone else? With that, I would renew my motion that House File 3662 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hilty. Representative Mullery.
Sure, thank you.
I will move that House File 3536 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes without recommendation. Representative Mullery. Representative Mullery, we are behind because I was in your committee. Just so you know, I blame you.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and it was a bill that you made the motion on.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you. This is quite simple. The bill, in essence, now is just regarding the fact that Minneapolis could use its tax increments from the housing replacement district for the same type of repair to properties that are outside the housing replacement district. And members, if you would go to parts of the North Minneapolis and parts of South Minneapolis, you would see the reason for this. There are blocks where more than half of the houses are knocked down or boarded up. A great many are in disrepair in certain areas. And it's really needed to free up a little bit of money to try and help repair this housing huge problem that we're facing right now. And with me today is Terry Q from the Northside Residence Redevelopment Council.
Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Sherry Q. Sullivan. I'm the Executive Director of the Northside Residence Redevelopment Council. I'm also a member of the Minneapolis Consortium of Community Developers and the Northside Neighborhood Alliance, which is a collaboration of the 13 neighborhoods in North Minneapolis. Our neighborhoods are located basically north of 394 from the Mississippi River to Theodore Worth Park. In 2002, our community thought that we had achieved the dream. Vacant lots were filled with new houses. Old homes had been renovated. But because of several key factors, starting in 2002, that achievement started to vanish. We experienced predatory lending aggressively, flipped mortgages, individuals lost jobs, families had health crises, crime started increasing, and other social inequities. We are now at a point that sometimes when you drive down our streets, you might think that you're in Detroit or Cleveland, Ohio. We are here to ask for your support in this bill because we know that there are three things we need to make a change in our community. That is the supporting and fostering of organizations and communities to rehab the housing dwellings and get our community rebuilt. The second is policies that will facilitate the acquisition management of this housing stock, which the bill before you will do. And third, the use of effective land use and redevelopment plans, which we are working with our city. The city of Minneapolis, for the last 3 years, we've had what's called the Northside Home Fund. And in that home fund, we've had clustered development strategies. The two-sided map that you have as a handout shows you two of those cluster strategies that we're trying to approach. One is north of Broadway, one is south of Broadway. And if you look, the one that's south of Broadway is the one that's in our neighborhood, and you'll see that in the first block, just north of Golden Valley Road, in one block, there are five boarded and abandoned buildings. Those weren't that way in 2005. So So this bill will help us in adjusting and making the changes we need to make in our neighborhood. Currently in the city, there's 560 boarded and abandoned and condemned buildings. Over 400 of those are located in North Minneapolis. So our situation is grave. We would hope that you would support this bill, and I'll be short and take any questions.
All right, questions from members. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on this, I don't know which is which neighborhood, but on this one where you see so much blue,
yeah.
How does it come to be that the county owns so many contiguous properties? Is this part of a redevelopment plan, or it just happened that those are like really unfortunate blocks?
They're unfortunate blocks. County, more than likely county ownership is because of property tax. Not paying property tax, so then the county comes in and purchases those sites.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, questions from members? Seeing none, anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, with that, I would renew my motion that House File 3536 be referred to the Committee on Taxes and Recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Moe. Oh, yes. Actually, Ms. Dyson had found the answer to Representative Olson's question. However, he's not in the room at the moment, so I'm going to have her tell the committee. Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, on the question of what does public notice mean, it does mean public notice. In the qualified newspaper statute, chapter 331A, it states that a public notice shall be public in a qualified newspaper. So I think the term for it is interchangeable.
All right. Questions from members? All right. Hearing none. I will move that House File 3437 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd also like to move a delete all amendment and work from the amendment.
I would move, not everyone has it yet, but I would move 1348, and we won't vote on it until everybody gets it. So why don't you speak to it?
Yeah, thank you. First, just briefly about the Star Lake and River proposal. The Star Lake and River proposal is building upon the idea of the Star City initiative that has been so popular in Minnesota. It is an opportunity for lakeshore associations to use the tools that are already at their disposal through the Department of Natural Resources and the Pollution Control Agency and their local soil and water conservation districts, along with the current efforts that are ongoing from their local units of government, counties and cities, taking those things together, making a management plan, getting some benchmarks that they have to meet, and as they make progress on that, on those benchmarks toward a management plan, clean water, vegetation reestablishment, things like that, then they would be designated as a Star Lake, something that it would be a kind of feather in their cap as a lake for real estate purposes, for tourism, and other things. We've been working on this for quite some time, but we'll also work with the Association of Minnesota Counties, League of Minnesota Cities, and the Bowser. I think we have a consensus proposal in front of you now that does what we want, but doesn't force cities and counties to duplicate anything that they're already doing, nor impinges upon their rights or responsibilities of government. In this particular amendment that's in front of you was worked on by the Association of Minnesota Counties and League of Minnesota Cities. They're in the room, and Mr. Johnson says this is all true, and he's completely supportive.
All right, well, I would move the amendment to get the bill on the state the author would like it. The amendment is 1348. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, and your testifier is Representative Moe.
Yes, John Gisecki from the Bowser Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Yep. John Gisecki, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources for Bowser. As Representative Moe indicated, this amendment basically, you know, removes any obligations of local governments to participate in this, although we certainly expect that they would want to join the lake associations to work on ways to improve the lake or the river, and then to be recognized for that and potentially put a little feather in their cap or gold star by their lake when they pursue grant monies and so forth. Again, the only concern our agency has is about the funding that may take to do this, and of course that's not an issue that this committee is, I'm sure, looking at today.
All right. Thanks so much. Questions from members? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moore, Mr. Jaffke, if there's a watershed district encompassing any of these lake associations, do they have a role to play in this, or is it all of the interaction is with Bowser and bypassing the watershed district? What's the end?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, the way the bill is structured, it doesn't mandate a connection to any local government, including a watershed district, but the expectation would be that those lake associations would be using the information and other resources that those local governments, counties, watershed districts, cities, stormwater conservation districts would have already developed, as well as the agency. So it doesn't obligate them, but they would be expected to participate any way they can by the lake association.
All right, further questions? All right, Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moore, when you said you had me until you said Mr. Johnson supported it, and you kind of made me get nervous. But on page 2, under the Comprehensive Lake or River Management Plan, line 20, where it says increasing or maintaining a healthy, diverse fishery that is appropriate for the lake or river. As you're well aware, we have a problem on Leech Lake. We've had a problem on many lakes in Minnesota. And it's very difficult right now to get the DNR to stock fish, do what the people want. We have an elected body up there that represents now the city of Walker, the counties, the townships around there, the lake association, and we've been trying to get the lake stocked with walleyes and increase that. But now I see here, is this going to be another group? Another entity that I'm going to have to go through before I can get the walleye stock that we need? And if so, could we put a date on this that doesn't go into effect until 2015?
Representative Mom.
Madam Chair, Representative House, I think you know that I'm with you on this issue, and if this provides us an additional tool to hold the DNR's feet to the fire, I think it would be a good one to have. I wouldn't anticipate that this would be another hoop that we have to jump through, but in fact, maybe some more support for our case.
Madam Chair, Representative Moll, could I look at this as more of a crowbar to move the DNR along rather than a roadblock?
Well, how about a pry bar or a large caterpillar?
That would work. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Stumper.
If I may, Representative Moore, I'm almost inclined to think that this is why government gets a bad name. It's kind of an explosion of government here. If this becomes law, won't the Board of Water and Soil Resources have to constantly go around and evaluate whether these star lakes or rivers are fulfilling their requirements under their comprehensive lake or river management plan?
Madam Chair, Representative Stumper, no, in fact, the converse is true. The onus is upon the Lakeshore Association, and they will have to show that they are, in fact, doing this, and if renew it every 5 years. And maybe Mr. Jaffe can speak to that, but the intention here is that this is a citizen-driven process. We have lakeshore associations and river associations around the state of Minnesota. This is just giving them a bit of a roadmap to more clearly do the work that they want to do already. We're not, and I would anticipate that the number of employees that Bowser would need to accommodate this would be one or two, and not creating a large bureaucracy. In fact, I share your concern with creating more of a bureaucracy. We're hoping to do exactly the opposite.
All right. Further questions from members? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 3437 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Next, we have Representative Hornstein. Members, we're going to keep plugging away. So, Representative Hornstein, I will move that House File 3718 be recommended, passed, and be placed on the General Register. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. House File 3718 is a bill that simply allows for an option for municipalities to take advantage of a what we believe is a fairly large pool of federal money, $10 billion available to businesses and governments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This idea came to me from Senator Jungbauer, who is carrying this bill over in the Senate. And again, this is not a requirement of local government. It's just simply, again, allowing local governments to take advantage of a federal grant program. It's a planning tool to inventory gas, electricity, and water use. With this information, again, governments and businesses will have a better starting point in the event that they want to apply for this money to plan for future infrastructure needs. Again, my understanding of this federal program is that it relates to energy and water consumption, and I would seek your support. I think it's a good efficiency bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative Holborn.
Representative Hornstein, is there anybody in opposition to this bill that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion. Oh, Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I just have to ask a question because I've seen this 100 times before. Representative Hornstein, how long until this is a mandated program?
Again, I'm not aware of any mandates that are attached to this. I think that in terms of the federal grant, this is I think an initiative that comes out of our growing concern about both greenhouse gas emissions and energy use in general. And I think at this point the approach is let's provide incentives, let's provide money, and see where we go from there.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, just the members. This is voluntary now. The forms will be standardized so that when it comes time to make it mandatory, it will be. Anybody who's ever run a business, members, energy costs of any kind are the number one thing in your mind. If there's a way to take advantage of, and I know they exist, any utility company will come and do an energy audit at no charge right now and help us figure out how to burn less gas, use less water, use less electricity, or use all of the above more efficiently. So, members, I think this is a solution looking for a problem. I'm sure the wings won't fall off if it passes this year, but I'll tell you, when it comes up as a mandatory program 5 years from now, remember I told you so.
All right. Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 3718 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right, Representative Hornstein, I will move that House File 3644 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Another energy-related bill. House File 3644 expands the time frame for contracts to facilitate investments in energy improvements in public facilities. Many northern states have expanded the time frame for these contracts to a 20-year period in order to facilitate financing of energy efficiency improvements. This bill came to my attention from the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority and the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, otherwise known as Minnesota NAHRO. And they have requested this legislation to enhance the method again for financing energy improvements. And I think that if members have questions about exactly how this will help out, we do have representative from the Minnesota Public Housing Authority who can explain the kind of work they're involved with energy efficiency, what they have in process, and explain why this particular bill will help to expedite the kinds of improvements they're trying to make. So with that, members, I'd like to call on our witness, John Fliska from the he's the manager of facilities and development for the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority.
All right. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Representative, good afternoon. My name is John Fliska.
Manager of Facilities and Development. We're from Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. We are one of the largest landlords in the state of Minnesota with assets valued at $600 million. We provide affordable housing assistance to over 25,000 elderly, disabled, and low-income persons. We own and operate 41 high-rise apartment buildings, 184 row house units, and 741 scattered site rental units. We are here today to support legislation that would change the term of energy saving projects in Minnesota from 15 to 20 years. On August 8, 2005, President Bush signed into law the Energy Policy Act of 2005. Part of that law allowed for the extension of energy service contracts from 12 to 20 years. This was done in order to allow for longer payback periods for various retrofits and increase the scope of work to include items with longer payback periods. While Congress increased the scope of these energy savings agreements for up to 20 years, Minneapolis Public Housing Authority is also covered by Minnesota law. The current 15-year term limitation has an estimated $10 million impact on the scope of energy saving contracting activity by the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. The additional 5-year window allowed by federal law would enable us to include things like exterior lighting, an important security measure for our residents and neighbors, medicine cabinets with internal lighting, a critical need for thousands of elderly residents who occupy our buildings, repairs to the building envelope, including caulking and sealing, which are essential for the preservation of our properties, replacement of windows, stove exhaust hoods, key HVAC components, as well as greening technologies. This allowance from the federal government is one of the few pieces of good news for public housing authorities over the past 10 years. HUD funding for public housing operations has reduced to 84 cents on every dollar that HUD's own formula has determined is necessary to operate public housing, and the capital fund that we have has been reduced similarly. The result is huge funding shortfalls for us. Our most recent needs assessment has identified some $222 million in unmet capital needs. We currently only receive about $10 million per year for capital improvements. With the Energy Services Agreement, we hope to address between $40 to $50 million of those needs and pay for them out of energy savings. Finally, this last year, the state of Minnesota, recognizing the threat of federal cuts to public housing programs, allocated about $5 million statewide to assist public housing authorities. We received $500,000 of this initiative, and we are extremely appreciative. Today, without spending any state resources, by simply changing current law from 15 to 20 years for energy services agreements, you can realize a $10 million effect on the resources the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority has to meet its needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? All right. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3644 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Kalin, you're next. Representative Kalin, you left the room. I called you up before, so you got bumped way down the list. So, Representative Kalin, if I can find where you are on the agenda, I will move your bill, but I don't know where it needs to go.
It's House File 3717. There should be a DE1 amendment that's been distributed.
I would move House File 3717 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
Yes.
And I would...
Yes.
I'm sorry? Okay, so we have the amendment. What is the amendment?
It's the DE1 amendment. I do have an oral amendment with deletion from the DE1 amendment as well after a consultation with SL.
Let's make sure that people have it.
We don't.
They don't.
Yet.
Somehow I have a copy. Sorry. Where are the pages?
Well, why don't you talk to us about it while they find it, and we'll just keep plugging along because we don't want to be here all night.
We actually, it was right on top of piles, looking for everywhere but right on top.
Go ahead.
Let me just introduce the bill. Madam Chair, members, House File 3717 is a bill to give local units to government a little bit more notice and encourage partnerships with utility companies when citing the specific route of transmission lines. It was developed in consultation with the City of Lindstrom in response to some lessons that we learned with the fast track routing and certificate of need permitting process and new transmission lines. And also, I want to thank Xcel Energy for working very closely, Dan Fikas specifically, working very closely with me to make sure that it does work for the utilities. Members, what happens often is that the utilities end up knowing with enough advance to that they're going to file an application for a new transmission line. And so this bill would actually say that within at least 120 days before they formally file the application with the Public Utilities Commission, they simply need to provide notice to each local unit of government that will be affected. And then each local unit of government can then request within 30 days of their request, they can request a consultation meeting with the utility. One of the things that we find is that, especially in the Lindstrom project or the Chicago project through Lindstrom, that we found is that there's some meaningful issues relating to the local routing that could have been resolved by more informal conversation, we believe. And certainly I think some of you might be familiar with the CapEx 2020 process in southern Minnesota, expanding transmission for renewables, that is actually doing this kind of pre-application consultation and public meeting process to get more public input, to build more support for these lines. And ultimately what we believe will happen if this bill is adopted is there will be fewer formal intervener cases and fewer formal contested cases as a result of these transmission line applications. Lastly, members, I want to direct your attention to line 1.17 through 1.19. I believe that Xcel and I are working out whether this actually does what we believe it will do, but of course, we want a moratorium adopted by a local unit of government after getting notice of a line should not apply to that line. I think that's a very fair fair addition. There is a local permitting option to bypass the PUC for actual permitting routes that I believe the construction moratorium will protect them against, or the provision will protect them against that moratorium. We're working out the specific details over whether it actually does that, but I believe that it does, and so we're working with the transmission folks. And I believe, members, that's the bill. City Administrator John Olinger from the City of Lindstrom is here. I think it's actually a brainchild that he and I worked up based on municipal consent of MnDOT projects. We didn't want to go that far, but thought notice is enough. So, members, that's the bill, and would appreciate your support.
Representative Holberg had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kalin, is there anybody in opposition to your bill that you know of?
I believe at this point that we've worked out the opposition to it and that the utilities are at least neutral with it and actually suggested the specific language that you see in front of you.
Representative Holberg, hello?
I'm ready to vote.
Okay, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, because I've been hearing rumblings to the other way, and members, I just want to caution you that I know the hope is this will actually speed up the overall process. This actually, in the initial way it works out, is going to slow things down even more. That will add some cost to the ratepayers because these are all rate recoverable members. Anything that we afflict the power companies with, they just pass right through to the ratepayers. But to Representative Kalin, Madam Chair, there is on line 1.14, 1.15. In 1.6, a single meeting requested by representatives of all local governments within the county with the applicant satisfies the requirement that somehow the power companies don't have to come out to your county and meet with 13 different localities. They can actually accomplish this in one meeting, which if we're going to afflict them with this, that seems to be the minimum we can do. Is that actually going to accomplish this and allow them to make one trip and meet with everyone?
Representative Kalin.
Representative Hilstrom, actually, that's the very sentence
that XL Energy has requested that we remove from the amendment. And so when it's time to move to remove that, they actually believe that the pre-application consultation meetings will help speed up the process, and that that language actually will end up kind of muddying it up a little bit. They'd like to
really
have the opportunity to meet with folks as the rest of paragraph B provides.
Okay, why don't I move the DE1 amendment, and why don't you tell us what you want to change in the DE1 amendment?
Madam Chair, members, after the period on line 1.14, delete everything after the period. Delete lines 1.15 and 1.16.
Is there anything else?
That is it,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Is Representative Stumper is yours to the amendment or to the bill?
Let's do the amendment.
Okay. All those in favor of the change signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. So now we have to adopt the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Stumper.
Representative Kaling, perhaps I'm not understanding this. Line 117, Part C. Does this somehow limit the right of a local unit of government to challenge this siting? It almost seems like it.
Representative Kaling.
Madam Chair, Representative Trumper, no, it doesn't limit it. Actually, that there's a formal intervener process that leads to what's known colloquially as a contested case with the utilities. That what this would merely say is, if our goal here is that if there's a workable agreement with the local units of government as a result of the pre-application consultation meetings, that then they could pursue a local permitting option for that specific part of the route that would not involve the Public Utilities Commission. It's an option available for them now, but what we'd like to do is encourage as many of those agreements where there's consensus to be able to move forward. So it does not limit the intervener option.
Representative Stumper.
Representative Kaling, what about the option of adopting a moratorium?
Representative Stumper.
Kaling.
Kaling, sorry.
That's all right, Madam Chair. That's what we're saying is that it is not, I don't believe it's appropriate that once we are actually putting legal notice in to an earlier step of the process, which doesn't add any more time, doesn't change the timing at all, but once there's earlier notice to the project, then we believe that it's only fair to the utility to say that once that legal notice is filed, that they can't adopt a moratorium. It's sort of like a, ha-ha, we gotcha.
So there's
that's not fair.
So there's an earlier notice at 120 days, and it's at that time that a unit of government can file a moratorium?
Representative Stumper.
Kaling, Madam Chair.
Sorry.
Okay.
It's been a long day.
I totally hear you. Representative Stumper, it's sort of common practice here that any time the local government is put on notice of a project, that a moratorium would not, taken after that point, would not apply. But before then, if a local unit of government is saying that a construction moratorium aimed at power lines, transmission lines, pipelines, could take that action before formal notice. So that option is still available as part of a proactive solution before any notice is formally given.
No, Chair.
Okay. Well, Representative Stumper, I was just checking with staff, and she is not certain if there is a separate statute dealing with these transmission lines versus our general statute.
And Madam, and I'm not
and
either.
Representative Beard is saying yes, there is.
There is.
And Representative Kaling is saying that yes, there is. And so this is not within our general statute.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, Representative Kaling, it just looks to me like as soon as they receive this notice 120 days before the filing of an application, that cuts off a local unit of government from filing a moratorium against this proposal. That's what it looks like.
Representative Kaling.
And that's what it is, Representative Trumper. That is correct.
Well, then I'll vote against it.
Well, Representative Trumper, if you'd like to move to delete that portion, that's certainly, and if the rest of the bill is amenable to you, that's certainly something that I could live with. And I believe the utilities are sort of agnostic on this, even if just kind of questioning whether it's worth keeping in the bill. So if you'd like to
to move to remove it.
Oh,
in that case, I'll move to delete lines 117 through 119.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Stumpert, anything else?
No.
All right, with that, I would renew my motion that House File 37. Could I ask if anyone in the audience wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, I have now. So with that, I would renew my motion that House File 3717 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank
Representative
you,
Otremba, sorry to make you wait. I heard that you're going to be very short. I will move that House File 3517 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Otremba. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a lot of patience. This is a bill about food and food handlers, and the bill makes various changes to food laws administered by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I have Dr. Heidi Kassenborg to do a synopsis of the bill.
Okay, go ahead. State your name for the record.
My name is Dr. Heidi Kassenborg. I'm the director of the Dairy and Food Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Go ahead.
This bill covers many primarily housekeeping statutes and language. The primary portion of this bill that relates to this committee has to do with the area of vending machines, and specifically those that we define as a water dispensing machine. Under our, in order to clarify what we mean by vending machines and what we do not, what we mean by water dispensing machines are those within grocery stores where you can go in and either bring your own container or have a container and fill it with water there. We want to make to clarify that these are exempt from licensing fees. And so, in order to match the language about non-exemption of licensing fees, that gets put in with those, with the other language that has to do with home rule charter and statutory cities, as well as counties.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3507 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Well, we were rounding up members because I have Representative Mark Ward's bill, and I have Representative Peterson's bill, which we are going to make a motion to reconsider, and then we have our controversial bills, which is Representative Peterson's and Hooper's bill. Wow. So, Representative Beard, do you want to make your motion?
Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair, I do. I would like to move to reconsider House Bill 2662, the original version as originally introduced.
Representative Beard moves that House File 2662 be reconsidered. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Members, I will move that House File 2662 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Representative Peterson. My understanding, you have an amendment, Representative Peterson.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would also like to thank the committee and Representative Beard for the motion to reconsider. You should be getting the original bill that we're reconsidering as well as two amendments and a handout that will show exactly what will happen with this motion. They're all passed out, right?
So there's the A3 amendment. Does everyone have the A3 amendment yet? No. Okay, we'll wait. All right, go ahead, Representative Peterson. Why don't you tell us what the bill is going to do after should both amendments be adopted?
Okay. This changes the language a bit from the first time that we would consider this bill. It really takes place after the reapportionment, and it will still stagger the terms, which is the main thing that we wanted to do. You know, we have a number of folks who say, well, we don't want to just stagger the terms. We want to really restructure all of the Met Council, or we want to do elections, etc. You know, the whole idea of restructuring the Metropolitan Council might be a good idea, but that is something that will take some time, a great deal of work, and in the meantime, we really do need to be sure that we have a continuity and a flow of action that makes some sense during these years in between. And so this language will provide that kind of continuity, independence, and the decision-making process that we need. And we need consistency and continuity. And due to the complexity and diversity of the issues that the Met Council faces in the future, I think it's essential that we have a continuing group of people who are acquainted with the issues that have been before them, and whether it's dealing with transit or wastewater or the other kinds of issues for the seven county metro area, it seems important that we have that kind of learning curve taken care of. And also, staggered terms may create less partisanship in selecting members, and it treats the agency as a more independent regional agency rather than one tied to the state administration. And so I would look, I think everybody has the motions at this point in time, and the sheet that you probably need to look at is the one that has the actual dates on the side. It's an independent sheet, and it has the action, and it shows exactly what will happen. Do we have that
one? We don't have that yet.
Oh, that means filling out
here. Okay, because the language can be confusing, and I think when people haven't, unless you sit down and diagram it on a whiteboard, it's kind of hard to tell exactly what happens, and this will show exactly how this bill will work, and you will have it before you in a moment. On the left side, you see the dates, the different years, and then you can see what happens in 2008, and the bill passes and becomes law. And then on the right side, you can see exactly what happens each of those years. And this actually will not begin until 2011, when the new four-year governor's term begins, and the current member's four-year terms expire, and the governor would appoint an entire council to two-year terms, and then all those terms would expire again because of redistricting, and then we would go into the staggered term. So this is different from the first one that we had, and I think it's probably more acceptable to everyone, probably more easily understood, and because of the need to redistrict, it would make seems to make more sense. So
questions from members? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, so understanding this, if the A2 and A3 are adopted, a new governor would eventually, within a two-year period, have the privilege of appointing the entire Metropolitan Council, just not in the first year of his term. He would have to wait until the beginning of the third year of his term. Is that my understanding?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. I'm going to ask my assistant here, who
right,
because
he's
more acquainted with how this exactly is implemented.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm with Metro Cities. We represent 86 cities in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. I think the easiest way to work through this is to just go down the chart. In 2011, a new...
Briefly, Mr. Jamboy.
I'll be real quick, Madam Chair, I promise. In 2011, a new gubernatorial term begins, and the current four-year terms expire. The governor appoints all the Metropolitan Council members to two-year terms. In 2013, as part of reapportionment, those terms all expire. The governor appoints odd-number districts to two-year terms and even-number districts to four-year terms. Then you'll see in 2015, a new gubernatorial term begins, and the governor appoints odd number districts to four-year terms. Those even number districts from two years prior carry over and into the new gubernatorial term. In 2017, the governor then appoints even number districts to four-year terms, and then there's a new election in 2018, and in 2019 the new terms begin. And so the governor with a new term in the next decade will appoint half of the members of the Met Council at the beginning of his or her term and the second half in the second year.
Right. Okay.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the staggering makes a whole lot more sense than what we saw before. But I still have a concern about the issue of removal for cause. Who determines removal for cause, and what establishes cause?
Representative Peterson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lanning. At this point, common law would establish the removal for cause, and that is an established, there is an established precedent for that. And so it would be, I think, in extraordinary circumstances that the governor would do that. And it would just give the reason that you can't be, this would say that you can't be capricious, and just because somebody doesn't agree with you, you say they can't be on the council anymore. There has to be a pretty definite reason. And so I think it's pretty established as to why and for what reasons people could be not or dismissed from the council.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it only the governor, or can other members of the Met Council or municipalities or counties ask for a removal?
It's the governor. They could ask the governor, but the governor is the one who does that.
So only the governor.
Only the governor
would determine cause.
Right.
All right. Further questions from members. All right. Seeing none, anyone in the audience wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, I would renew my motion. Whatever it is. We have to give the amendments first. Sorry, guys. I'm a little off today. I would move the amendment, the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. I would move the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. With that, I would renew my motion that House file 2662 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. All those in favor? Oh,
Madam Chair, I do have one quick question about procedure.
Certainly.
And I want to express thanks for clarifying this and giving us a chance to actually understand how it could work without looking like we were politically advantaging or disadvantaging any particular governor or potential governor. But when it gets to, I noticed in after the next redistricting in 2013, the odd number district gets a 2-year term. In 2023, Mr. Jamboy, the even number districts get the terms, but we, the legislature, that actually redraw the boundaries and assign the numbers. Any thought given to that, or are we just going to kind of wing it and hope for the best there?
Mr. Jamboy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Beard. It was simply a way to try to provide a flip-flopping of district appointments. Mm. In the previous Met Council, all of the one type of member were changed out at two years, and that, you know, was okay. This just seemed to be a better way to do the appointment process, in that the district boundaries may change, but much of the districts themselves will be the primary district.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to get that on the recorded record so that in 2023, when somebody's redistricting the Met Council, they knew that we actually thought about that.
All
and
right.
Can endeavor to kind of keep them lined up.
All right. I would renew my Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I wasn't here for this illustrious previous hearing. But Representative Peterson, if I may, Madam Chair, I would like an elected Met Council. And so is your bill getting me closer to that or further away from that?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Lenteski. Well, I've had more discussions with people about the Metropolitan Council the last week than I ever thought I would, and I've learned a lot. And it seems to me that there's a real consensus we need to look at the Metropolitan Council as a whole, examine what other states do, talk about whether this is 7-county, 11-county, 13, whether it's an elected board, and that the whole restructuring piece, reframing perhaps of the Metropolitan Council. But that will take some time, a great deal of effort, and I'm sure a great deal of controversy. but whether this is moving you toward an election, I'm not sure. I think this is a good thing to have in place in lieu of an election, and hopefully at some point in time we'll be able to consider an election. I know many people said, I'd like to see an election of the council members, but right now that doesn't seem to be in the cards. So this is a stopgap measure.
Anything else? All right. I will renew my motion that House File 2662 be recommended passed and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Peterson.
I just want to say thank you to Jim Solem, who came back again and waited patiently.
Oh, thank
you. He was such a good person to testify, and I really appreciate his being here again.
All right. Representative Marquardt, you can move that House File 3646 be recommended passed and be placed on the general register.
So move, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
House File 3646 deals with the threshold amounts on the municipal contracting law, dealing with when you have to do sealed bids and so forth for local units of government. Let me tell you briefly what it does. Right now, the current level for sealed bids for a city or county school district has to go to sealed bids is $50,000. This would raise it to $100,000. Right now, there's a range from $10,000 to $50,000 on a contract where you could have either sealed bids or direct negotiations with two quotes or more. That $10,000 to $50,000 would be raised from $25,000 to $100,000. And then on less than $10,000 contracts, you can base it on two quotes. This would move that $10,000 to $25,000. It also brings in drainage authorities in with this law. And Madam Chair, it also deals with best value alternative, that best value law where you could do bids on performance and price, which was your bill last year.
Yes, it was.
It moves those up. Just very quickly, you know, why are we doing this? The last time this was changed was the year 2000, you know, inflation. There is a city in my district that is doing some road work, so I asked them to quickly give me cost of things. And for a mill and overlay of 1 mile of street, 38 feet wide, 1 mile of mill and overlay is $226,000 was their estimate. So at $100,000, that'd be about half a mile of mill and overlay. And a total reconstruct, 1 mile, 8-inch asphalt, 38 foot wide, $1.3 million per mile. So you could do about a tenth of a mile for $100,000. So, I mean, I suppose we could talk about what would be the proper level to raise this to. I think $50,000 is too restrictive, doesn't really match the times. And I've got Ken Sulem here. This is brought to me by the Association of Townships, and I know there's other groups, and he can kind of give you a little more detail quickly.
Mr. Sulem.
Representative Hilstrom, members of the committee, Ken Sulem with Minnesota Association of Townships. This bill was brought to our association through our legislative process. Because in the rural areas, quite simply, we're not getting bids. When we go out and advertise and spend hundreds of dollars putting the notices in the paper for these relatively small projects by today's contracting standards, nobody is responding. And so instead of saving money, we're actually expending funds. This bill would allow us to save money. We also have situations where used equipment is becoming available right around that $30,000 mark. And we can't, or $20,000 market mean, and we can't do anything with it because we can't get the second quote. And so by doing this, we're actually going to be saving money. This bill is fully supported by all the local unit government associations, schools, cities, counties, etc. I did talk to the representatives from some of the contractors, and they said this is a very reasonable threshold and they would not oppose us. They promised they'd get back to me if they changed their mind. They did not do so, so I'm assuming that standard is still in play, that the contractors are not opposed to this bill. They never came back to me and said it was reasonable when I talked to them. And so we ask for your support.
Representative
Stumper. Madam Chair, Representative, Mr. Sulem, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you get one bid, you can grant the contract, can't you?
Mr. Sulem.
Representative Stumper, if you get one bid, you can grant a contract. What I'm saying is what's happening right now is you either get no bid for the small project, or if you get the one bid, it's the same local contractor who's doing all the work anyhow, and so you know who's going to get that one bid, and you spend hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars, advertising for the bids, and you get the same contractor each and every time. by increasing the thresholds will save the publication costs for the sealed bid process. It's very substantial.
I want to say, Mr. Sewell, I'm skeptical about this. I haven't been in local government. I just am real skeptical. There's a lot of good old boy decision-making goes on a lot of these projects, and the only thing that keeps it at arm length, in my opinion, is that they have to at least go through the process of bidding. And so I have to say I think this is maybe a mistake.
Representative Shumper, I mean, this is brought by the local units. Like I said, I don't know what's keeping them at arm's length, so nobody's responding to the request. We're still required to get quotes. We're increasing. The only time we could go out on the open market is for the under 25, which is currently 10,000. That hasn't been adjusted in many, many times, because when we upped it to 50,000, we didn't adjust the bottom threshold. So this is the first time we've adjusted that in probably a couple of decades. And so it's really just keeping pace with what's reality out there, because we can advertise and nobody's submitting, so we are spending tax dollars for nothing coming back.
Representative Fishkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, question to you. The Section 5 and Section 7, the best value alternative, did I hear Representative Marcourt correctly as to say that was a law you passed just last year?
Representative Fishkin, I did best value. I want you to know that best value is not what was used for the bridge. That would be something that was design build that I believe Representative Beard carried. So as Representative Seifert is ranting and raving about who did what to whom on the bridge, just so you know, that one was carried by a Republican. So.
Madam Chair. I wasn't going down that road, but that was good. No, Madam Chair, I just had a question of the author of the bill.
Certainly, Representative Marcourt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marcourt, this is these sections deal with components that have been into law just since last year, and Representative Hillstrom is a very quality legislator, as you would certainly agree, I'm sure, my friend. Why, in less than a full year, do we have to amend her language and change these dollar amounts already? I thought she did a pretty good job last year, and we don't even have this going into law, and we're already jacking up the bank. Yep. Representative Marcourt, are we going to keep coming back to this year after year after year, and someday somebody will beg us to put us out of our misery and take the caps out completely?
Madam, Representative Vincent, that does hurt. That really does hurt. You know, actually, we maybe should have some sort of an indexing on this, quite frankly, because it is something that's just a... But, Representative Biskins, the best value that was put in the Chapter 16C.02 last year really just linked already with the dollar amount. That, her bill didn't set the dollar amount. It just set in there that you could go through this best value process. And so, what's the correct number? I don't know. It might be, if you're looking at inflation, 85,000 or whatever. But, maybe this is something where you put an inflationary ultimately in there. But the reality of it is that a $100,000 project, if you're dealing with any type of road or street, is really minor. I mean, it might be patching up some potholes, more than that. But it isn't any reconstruct or much on overlay and milling and that type of thing, but you bring up great points.
Is anyone in the audience wish to testify for or against this bill? Hearing none, Representative Marcourt will renew his motion that House File 3646 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all.
Thiessen. Members, this is a big bill, but a very small section of this bill has to do with the local government committee, and so we are going to restrict. We're not going to explore the whole photocop provision in this committee. So, Representative Thiessen, please go ahead.
Yes, sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for giving us a chance to present this bill. This is legislation which would give cities at their option the ability to install cameras at red lights, basically. And is there a particular section that you wanted to focus on?
Well, the first thing that I need to ask is,
Is there a fiscal impact? I need to know whether this goes to the general register or if it has to go to finance.
It has a fiscal savings of $2 million. $2 million in the biennium. $2.4 million.
So it does need to go to finance.
It's a positive, but it could go to public safety finance. That's where the savings are showing up.
Okay.
Well, I mean, we could go to the floor and they could take the credits for it as well. I mean, there's not a fiscal cost to the state. There's just a...
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, this isn't going to transportation this year.
Madam Chair, this bill, in essentially the same form, except for the fact we added a two-year sunset, went through transportation last year, and both committee chairs have said they don't need to see it again.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Tell me where you want it to go, and that's where we'll send it.
I prefer to send it to the floor. If we could, and if Tamar wants to plug it into his bill, that would be fine, too.
Okay.
But it should get sent to the general register.
All right. Then I will move. Even though I voted against this bill every single time I've ever seen it, I will move that House Ross
I do that myself.
We recommend your pass and be placed on the general register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just briefly to explain what the legislation, it's really a public safety tool. The city of Minneapolis had this for about 8 months and saw a 31% reduction in crashes and a 42% reduction in T-bone crashes. It's been shown that it saves lives, avoids injuries, avoids property damage, ultimately will save on insurance rates. It's consistent with what other states have done. And I think one thing that's important for folks to know is, you know, unlike the 300 cameras that we have watching us every day as we wander around the Capitol, whether we're doing something wrong or not, the cameras in this, these red lights are only tripped if someone runs a red light. So only if a violation occurs are the cameras tripped. The data must be destroyed within certain parameters. And so really what this is about, it will have a positive fiscal impact for the state, both as a matter of kind of the bottom line budget, but also, you know, in terms of saving healthcare costs and all those types of things. And so I would just add, I don't know if there's a specific provision you wanted to focus on, Madam Chair, that's related to public safety, to local government. We did add in the Public Safety Committee a provision that sends some of the funds to our EMS providers, who as many of you may know, are struggling currently, especially the rural ones.
Okay, members, we actually didn't request this. It was just sent to us.
Oh.
And the reason it was sent to us was because of Section 4, page 2, it plans a new local authority. And so whatever committee had it decided that we needed to see it. And also that on page 3, subdivision 2 has some things about the municipality, you know, getting the money. And so people just, I wasn't in the room when they heard it, and people thought we would need to see it, so they sent it to us.
Oh.
So, questions from members. Representative Stumper.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Thiessen, this was found to be unconstitutional at one time, wasn't it?
Representative Thiessen.
It was the Supreme Court found the city's ordinance unconstitutional under a provision of our Minnesota State Constitution that requires uniformity between state laws and city ordinances. And so a city ordinance can't, if a state law covers a particular subject, like red lights, a city ordinance can't exceed or be different than that. But it was not, that was the constitutional principle under which it was struck down.
Oh, really?
That wouldn't apply to a state statute. And because it's a petty misdemeanor, the kind of due processy kind of things don't apply.
All right. Representative Holland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to drift away from local government issues, but when he said the state's going to save a couple million dollars, I got to know, how are we going to save $2 million?
Representative
Thiessen. It's a positive impact because of they're catching more people running red lights.
Can we get more?
And you get a
so, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we're fining people $2 million more than normal.
So, yes.
All right. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. But I also think in response there, it might save a lot of insurance costs down the road with injuries and so forth. But, you know, when I was mayor and dealing with small city, I used to hear more complaints about people rolling through stop signs. And, of course, we had one police officer on duty. There's not much we could do. We weren't going to put... But, you know, whether or not you're at a store or ATM machine or in a parking lot, wherever you are, I forget what percent of the time you're being videotaped out there. So this is... You don't even realize it. I think that this is going to help with some enforcement on traffic, and if the, in fact the statistics are accurate on reducing those types of injuries and crashes, let's, this is for Minneapolis, or is this
any
just any city could do that? I mean, I say give it a go.
All right, Representative Lenteschi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Thiessen. I thank you for doing this bill. It is very controversial. I'm a big supporter. And I, you know, the Big Brother arguments and the privacy arguments are the one Jelly Fair, and it, you know, there have been some challenges in other states. But, you know, I just want to put on the record, because I have a lot of constituents who love this and who hate it. And, you know, I'm a former city council member, and I have disliked the assertion that folks try to ticket people because it's fun or they want money. And these people are killing people. I mean, and the only way that people have to worry about this is just don't run any red lights. They're not going to pay any fines. So there is the deterrent effect. I know it's very controversial. I don't know what the likelihood of your bill is of getting all the way through, but it's time, and I completely support this legislation.
And Madam Chair, I do want to emphasize again, there is a 2-year sunset on this as well, so we will have to come back and see if it actually does make a difference and if there's any problem.
Your test tires waited all day. Let's let them speak.
Thank you.
Good morning. At least it's morning for me. I'm Lieutenant Greg Reinhardt, Minneapolis Police Department. I'm the manager of the Stop on Red program. I'm also a street commander for the city of Minneapolis. I've been with the police department for a short time, 20 years, but I have never seen any type of traffic enforcement that has this effect on driving behavior. And that's our goal in traffic management. I was a former traffic unit commander, and we tried to shape, change, or modify people's behavior. Sometimes we did that with a coupon. We call them tickets. But what we try to do is change the way that people drive to make the roads and the freeways safer to drive. In Minneapolis, there's approximately 15,000 accidents a year, 3,100 injuries, 20 people die, and out of that, 4 to 5 people die because of red light running. We've been able to change those driving behaviors, not by having a cop at a red light 24 hours a day, it would be cost prohibitive, but by being open, by being transparent, by telling people where our red light cameras are, and then letting people decide whether they're going to change their behavior or not. Ultimately, if you're going to run through a red light, it's not so much about getting a ticket, it's are you going to cause an accident? Are you going to get hurt? Are there associated costs and other life-changing events because you went through a red light? This system, and there's a variety of ways that you can configure it, it worked. And we proved that in the 8.5 months that we had the Stop on Red program.
All right, questions. Representative Markwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering, Representative Thiessen, if we could put in any city who uses this, just keep track of the data. It would be nice after 2 years, since it's going to sunset, and the reason you do that so you can take a look at the program, and I think the statistics are readily available, if I'm hearing that, if we could say whoever uses that has to keep track of statistics and come back kind of with just a comparison. I mean, would that be something?
And I think that's I'd certainly be open to that. I know Minneapolis did that and will do that. So we can, if we want to add some language, I'm happy to add that in if we need to on the floor. You know. Or if you want to do it here.
Representative Markwart.
Well, I'm hoping you know also that the less traffic accidents you have in Minneapolis might hurt your local government aid, because that's one factor, remember, is the number of accidents. So there might be a little offset there in LGA, too. But
all right, that's one more.
But I would make that amendment of some sort, if or whatever how we would. I mean, I don't have it, just.
Right.
Okay. You have a presentation that you're going to make, and actually staff had to run upstairs because there's some question on whether or not we can send a bill that has a positive fiscal amount to the floor without it going through finance. So
this is just to show you kind of what these T-bone crashes are like, what we're talking about here.
Oh my.
And I just have one more if you want to. I just learned how to do this, so. Well, I did it in the last minute. You probably thought that, but. All right, this is.
Classic.
Oh, wait, this one's on.
Brown hair.
Oh, that's. So that's what it's kind of, and that those kind of tracks, we had a 42% reduction at these intersections, avoiding those. That's all the extent of my presentation. So there you go.
Great. Questions from members? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none.
You know, if you want to send it to, oh, they're back.
They're not back.
If
yet.
You want to send it to finance, I mean, why don't we wait and see what?
It'll just be okay. A minute. Representative Biskin, would you like to fill the time?
Well, yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I can fill some time. I've been able to do that before. All right. I find it rather interesting, you know, looking at what our current president is doing through his Patriot Act and now here in the House. Once upon a time, I could rely on a good liberal to make sure that Big Brother wasn't breathing down our necks at all times, all right? We're kind of losing that here. Yeah, I do have concerns, and I know that there are cameras out there, Representative Marquardt. I'm not ready to give up and say, well, that's just the way it is, all right? I do think, hopefully one day, we will go back to saying, you know, a person and a society isn't good because we've got a whole lot of cops and a whole lot of cameras watching their every movement. A person and a society is good because people are good, because they have a moral character and they have a moral, a sense of integrity. They have a sense of responsibility that when you're in a 3,000-pound vehicle, you're paying attention, for goodness sake, all right? Whether or not this actually works, I hope it does. You know, my father's best friend was killed just a few years ago out on 169 by somebody who blew a stoplight. So I'm well aware of this issue. But I'm not ready to capitulate yet. Do we have the answer, Madam Chair, or should I continue on?
We have an amendment.
We do.
So Representative Marquardt is just getting the language to get the reported information or the information correct.
Madam Chair, I do have a comment. I could take up a moment of time.
Certainly. Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, I will have an amendment on the floor or in finance if it goes there first. Just mainly because the metro cities like this, it looks like mostly cities like it. My amendment would be to keep this within the boundaries of the Met Council and not in northern Minnesota. Later, just so you're not you're made aware early.
Representative Howes, to shorten the debate, you may want to pick a population. Potentially,
well, I may do
that.
Yes.
The Metropolitan Council language doesn't appear anywhere in this bill. Otherwise, we may be days on the debate. So.
My point would be to make months on this bill and just possibly miss the deadline. My
Representative Thiessen.
We can talk more about that. I would note that, for instance, Thief River Falls did have a program like this previously.
Well, Madam Chair, Hackensack and Akeley, both of my districts, very small towns, are just learning how to use the administrative ticket. And the photo cop idea would be well taken in Hackensack and Akeley, and I don't think it would be well taken by the residents or the tourists that come up through those towns during the summertime.
All right, questions for members? Well, staff is not back yet. So, yeah, you have an amendment. Ms. Thiessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, sorry about that. There we go. The proposed amendment, I hope I'm placing it in the correct place, but on page 3, after line 36, insert a new subdivision. Subdivision 5, data report, semicolon report. A local authority that implements a program under this section must collect and report to the chairs of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over public safety, aggregate data on the program, including the number of citations issued and accidents before and after the program is implemented. The report is due January 15th, 2011.
Representative
Holberg.
Representative Marquardt would consider the friendly amendment to that amendment to also have a delineation of the money raised as well.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, first of all, I'll move that amendment. And then I guess I would have no problems in adding the amount of money taken in by the fines and then how that would be used. Or is that what you were saying, Representative Holberg, or what was your...
Yeah, something about the revenues and expenditures related to the...
Representative Thiessen, how do you feel about that?
I would be just fine with all of that. And I think Minneapolis at least does that, and we have that information. And I think because the municipalities have to report most of that information to the state anyway, it would, they could break that piece up.
Okay.
I will accept that as a friendly amendment.
All right. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Wojcicki?
Yes.
I know you're, I think you're on finance. Do you know, can we send bills to the floor that have a positive fiscal impact?
I don't think so.
Okay. So I would change the motion that it go to finance. All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Wait, let's do that again. Sorry. It makes money.
It makes money.
I don't know.
More revenue.
I don't think you can send it to the floor if it's positive.
As a fiscal note.
That's the debate, and we haven't heard back from staff yet. Anybody know?
I think it should go to finance. I don't know if this matters, but the tax bills that make money, they go to Ways and Means. They don't go to finance.
Okay. Well,
so I don't know.
I would move that it go to finance because then it's alive and it meets the deadline.
Sure.
Okay. Oh, here's Peter. Do you know? Does it go to finance?
No.
Oh, well, we don't have it yet, so we're going to move it to finance. Okay. All right, and in the event that we need to change that, we're going to hear Representative Holberg's bill. I'd be happy to change that and send it and then notify you.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, so at this point, I would renew my motion that it be recommended to pass and be sent to the committee on the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative. Oh, okay. A division's been requested. All those in favor signify. Raise your hand. All those opposed? Motion prevails. I was right.
Good to hear. Thank you, member.
Thank you. Well, tell him that. All right, Representative Holberg. Members, this is an issue that I believe needs to be heard. We are not going to be voting on this issue, for those of you that have to be in other committees to vote on issues, but I really think that we need to flesh this issue out. So, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for the brief time to just present our bill and hold over for future discussion. But the problem is that there's a great disparity between community to community and how they collect revenues. And the state authorizes municipalities to collect revenues for particular purposes, but maybe to illustrate, or using a term that we hear around here occasionally, cities also have been known to extract parting gifts in putting together their final contracts and requiring developers to do additional things that the city may or may not have the express authority to ask. And also one of the problems is waiving any right to challenge any assessments under a particular statute. And so, of course, the developers want to come into a community and develop, so they're kind of at the mercy, if you will, of the municipality, and in some communities this has gotten really out of hand. I have with me today Mr. Coyle, from the Builders Association, who will give you a little more information.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate that your time is short, so I'll cut this to the chase. The gist of the bill is page 2, and the issue is this. Cities have the authority to use development contracts when they're approving development projects. And we like that approach. We think that gives cities and developers flexibility. But what's happened over the last few years is that cities have taken that authority and they've used it to impose additional conditions on projects that are outside of the statute, we would say. And so this bill, as proposed, would attempt to define areas where cities can seek additional funding out of a developer beyond the statutory authority that they have. It also would impose a mandatory notice requirement on cities so that developers don't show up at their boat and then they're handed a lengthy contract that governs the terms and conditions of their approval without the time to review and understand what it means. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the author? Is there anyone?
This is Tim. Yes,
Representative
Hilbert. People opposed to this that we'll be happy to work with in the intervening months.
Very good. Is there anyone who would care to testify for or against this House file?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Again, I'm Louis Jamboy from Metro Cities, and I'm here just to talk for a second. I'm testifying on behalf of Metro Cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, and the Association of Townships. Those folks are in a variety of places right now. But we have been working with the builders over the last summer. We've traded information back and forth, language back and forth. We've vetted that stuff with our members, come back with feedback, and we are working, I think, in good faith with them and they with us, and we want to continue to work on this issue with them.
Great. Questions from members? Hearing nothing else. With that, I will lay that over. We do need to approve the minutes, and I just wanted to clarify to members that the reason that bill did need to go to finance, and the reason it needed to, the photocop bill needed to go to finance, is because it's a fee that would be charged, so it's an increase in fee, so even though it saves the state money, it would need to go to finance anyway. So, good thing we sent it there. All right, now we need to approve the minutes of February 27th as corrected. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Representative Scalzi moves the minutes of February 27th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And I need the minutes from March 10th.
So moved.
Representative Marquardt moves the minutes from March 10th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. And the minutes from March 5th. All those in favor.
So moved.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And the minutes from March 3rd.
So moved.
Representative Scalzi moves the minutes from March 3rd. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Members, we have to meet on Friday. We got our work done. However, because there is not a session today, we could not get all of the work from all the other committees. And so we have to meet on Friday in order to hear the bills that other committees have not yet passed out. All right? Motion, or we are adjourned.